swear you ordered it, you got it, and you told us about it on the show.
No, I've not.
No, I don't think so.
So what happened? So in the intervening times, other random Amazon sellers with those vowel combination names that they last about 6 months before they disappear and make new vowel combination names. They have come up with entries in this product category, and at the same time, I have been facing a problem as I am using my iPhone 15 Pro in usually some kind of case on the dashboard of my car, like in the dash mount on road trips. As it's getting warmer, it's starting to become a problem that my phone is really getting like quite hot in the car while being used this way.
Why don't you use CarPlay?
You should. You definitely should.
I'm going to say that every time you bring this up.
You should. So anyway, it's getting so hot that the screen starts dimming and the battery can't keep up with the charge and everything. So I'm like, this is kind of annoying. It's also probably not good for the phone for its battery life and et cetera, and for its components to be like super hot for hours on end as I'm doing like a long road trip.
You should buy your car an iPhone. Remember when you bought your car a watch? iPhone that's just for the car.
Anyway. So I ordered two product entrants in this category. One is just like basically a direct copy of the Razer thing. So it's just a fan with a thermoelectric plate in it to chill below ambient temperature. And it just has a USB-C input. And it mounts via MagSafe. So it doesn't charge the phone. So if I use this thing, it was something like $30. It wasn't a lot of money. I was a little wary, because the way thermoelectric plates work, it's incredibly power consuming, and it's nothing a heat pump. It's nothing like a heat pump, like an air conditioner, where you can get pretty cool temperatures that are not that much energy. No, those Peltier plates use a ton of power to make a little bit of cooling, and so I thought, how much could I possibly get out of a USB-powered fan for $30 on Amazon? How cool could it possibly get? Let me tell you, this thing that only does that and has this little fan in it, surprisingly cool. It's cool to the touch immediately upon plugging it in, and it actually cools the phone pretty well. That being said, the one that just mounts to the back and just like a standalone thing it's not really made to be used in a car. What I wanted for the car was a MagSafe charging puck on some kind of mount that could stick to the dash in some way that also had cooling built in.
Does this actually exist? I'm assuming you're about to tell me it does.
Of course it exists because of Amazon. So it not only does it exist, there's 25 of them, all again from these weird, no-name brands. So of course I got two of them to try because I didn't know what would fit my car. There's not a lot of options that have a stick-on mount. Usually they require the vent mounting, which the placement of the vents in Rivians, it's only down low, so there's not really anywhere to put something like that. Anyway, so I tried one of these, and I actually took my last road trip with it. I went upstate about a week ago, and it worked fantastically. So let me just set expectations accordingly. That version of it that has charging and a cooler in it, the phone does not get cool. It is not strong enough. It just can't keep up. That's a huge thermal load. It does not keep up. It does not keep the phone cool. However, it does keep the phone a lot less warm. And so it keeps it from overheating. It keeps the screen from dimming. It keeps it very slowly charging. And so it actually does serve a pretty useful function here, in the summertime when my phone was getting so hot in regular car rides. It was hot to the touch. It actually works. So this ridiculous thing in my car that was from some no-name brand that has a thermoelectric plate and a cooling fan behind my phone and MagSafe charges it actually works and is totally worth the whatever $35 or $40 it was. So,
oh my gosh.
I gotta say, if you have this problem, check out this category of products. You don't think it would work. It shouldn't work, and yet it does work.
Yeah, you already mentioned this, the Rivian vents are down low or whatever, but the regular car version of this, in my car, is where my charging MagSafe magnetic mount is clipped to an air vent. just turn the AC on and it blows AC air on the back of my phone the whole time I'm driving and my phone gets cold, literally
cold.
Yeah,
I mean, that is the better approach if you have that option.
I mean, I don't know if it's not intentional. I don't actually like it that it's blowing air on it because in the winter it blows hot air. But, you know, the fact is my phone doesn't overheat.
Can you put a link to this, certainly in the show notes? Can you share it with us so I can laugh at how ridiculous this is?
Oh, yeah, it's bad. I mean, because it's hideous. I mean, here, let me show you. Hold on.
So you said, like, the Rivian vents, like, you can't clip anything to them? They're just too weird, like, weird electric car-y type vents, and they're down
too low? They are weird electric car-y vents, but, yeah, the bigger problem is that they're mounted down, like, at the bottom of the dashboard. It's not a great place for them even just to be vents. Like, I don't even like the way they function as vents that way. Like, they're a little low for that, although Hops loves them. But yeah, it's like a little too low.
Yeah, the R1S and R1T have probably the world's most inefficient space usage in their dashboard. Like, you have no glove box, right? They fixed that in the later models. Huge dashboard, just cavernous, gigantic, no glove box.
All right,
and
so I just put a link in the chat for this is the one I ended up using because this has
it's
the
like
stick
a big
on
tongue.
Thing. I know,
it's
yeah,
like it's like a gigantic
a big
tongue
licking an ice hockey puck.
So yep, I have that. Confirm. I'm using that mount with this second one, with this charging pad, because this one was a little bit, had a little bit stronger cooling.
I love that the artwork makes it look like it's going to make frost form on your phone, which I think would not be good.
No.
this is something.
I know. Let me see if I can dig up
Truthfully, it's not as bad as I thought, but it's not great.
No, I mean, it's ugly, but you don't see it. And one thing I was surprised by, the fan really is not loud. Like, you really don't hear the fan.
Cars are loud. Like, it's going to be drowned out by the
not his
sound of
yeah,
the
electric
car.
Cars aren't. I was actually concerned
about
that.
Just like the wind noise and tire noise alone.
Yeah, I mean, the tire noise, yeah, for sure. Like, you do hear that. But I was very pleasantly surprised that it actually is really not too loud. Here, this and this one, if you just want a cooler and not a charger, this is the other one that actually cools it substantially better. And, like, they're all kind of limited by how much power they're going to draw from USB. Like, I have one of those little USB power meter things, and the Lyson one draws the most. That's about 20 watts while charging a phone and cooling. That seems to be the max. Everyone else is around, like, 12 to 15 watts. But, I mean, they could cool it substantially more if they drew more power, but I think they just don't, they figure,
well,
like,
how many watts can you get through a cigarette lighter adapter thing? I'm assuming that's where you're plugging this in.
You can get like 100 watts out of one of those if you try.
Well, I'm assuming you plug it into a USB port, not into the cigarette lighter adapter.
Yeah, like these, they all just have USB-C ports, and they do support power delivery. Yeah, they do. I tested that. So like they could theoretically use USB power delivery to have like even higher rates, but for some reason they don't do that, and I haven't looked into that further. But like I haven't found one that does for whatever reason. But this, look, these are fine. Like they work fine. It's a bit of this is ridiculous. You shouldn't need to do this. Our phones shouldn't be overheating when just operating in a car, but they do, and here we are.
Well, I don't know if you can blame it on the phone. I mean, I would blame it on the car maker for making
you use
your phone
in
that way.
I'd blame it on the rain.
But, like, because the car is, like, you know, even when you're driving, I know it's, like, air conditioner or whatever, but it's, like, in direct sunlight, right? That's
pretty
not a
much.
Great... And it's like a little greenhouse. It's a difficult situation.
Yeah, and I'm using wireless charging, which of course like you know generates some heat. And I have a case around the phone, which of course you know also you know basically insulates the heat on the inside. So you know there's a lot of factors working against it, but it is kind of a ridiculous problem. But a ridiculous problem deserves a ridiculous solution, and I found one.
Well, I'm very happy for you. My word. You know, you could just use CarPlay, and it would be so much better. But nope. All right, let's do some follow-up. Cy Wazam, or something like that, wrote with regard to the Snapdragon X10, whatever this is, trillions of operations per second. And that person wrote, while 40 TOPS is the minimum spec for something to be called a Copilot Plus PC, all Snapdragon X Elite and Plus chips are actually rated at 45 trillion operations per second.
Apologize for underselling the Snapdragon X, 45 TOPS.
Excellent. I am glad to hear it. Justin Long has come back around. I don't know. I actually really liked him when he was very popular like 15 years ago, but he is the actor that you would know as the Mac to the foil of John Hodgman's PC. And he came back to promote Qualcomm powered Windows PCs? I don't even know what to make of this. But The Verge writes, Apple's former alma Mac actor Justin Long defected to Intel a few years ago, and now he's looking to switch to a Qualcomm powered Windows PC. During Qualcomm's Computex 2024 keynote today, Long appeared in a brief 30-second skit where he was bombarded by macOS notifications and nag screens, causing him to start searching for a Snapdragon powered PC instead. Cool.
Well, a link to Gruber's post about this, which covers pretty much everything I wanted to say about it, but yeah, the main thing that's really baffling is like, okay, so, you know, you get the actor that was in an Apple ad campaign, you try to ride on Apple's coattails, you do a thing, Intel has done it before, apparently he's done this for Huawei as well, whatever. But, like, you have to have some motivation for the person in the ad to be saying, I'm dissatisfied with Apple, so I'm going to get a Copilot Plus PC or whatever, right? But the reason he's dissatisfied is he gets notifications. Like, the email has arrived and stuff? I mean, you can turn off notifications. Like, they should have asked an actual Mac user, what's annoying about macOS? We can tell you. Like, there are things you could put in the ad that are legit. But what they had in the ad was like, why does this make him want a new computer? It is just not a sensible ad. And it shows, like, real just not... Again, just ask anyone who has a Mac. They'll tell you what's annoying about macOS. For example, like I think the people have done ads on this. All the stupid permission things, right, that pop up, you know, that we've been complaining about for ages, that Jason Snell had a big post about when he had to set up a new computer. That's actually annoying. Show those flying in his face and saying, boy, I just tried to set up a new computer, and I had to give a million different permissions to a million different apps. I'm going to get a Snapdragon X Copilot Plus PC because then I won't have to deal with that. I don't know if that's actually true, but that would be a sensible ad showing an actual pain point, but this failed to do that. So anyway, I'm glad he's getting paid to do ads, and it is really just embarrassing move to be trying to play off of a very now very old Apple ad campaign rather than making your own ad campaign, but you know, advertising is what it is.
Sure is. All right. So Windows recall. Everyone seemed to be really worked up about how this was going to be a security nightmare. And I'll actually admit that I assumed that Microsoft knows what they're doing. This surely can't be as bad as everyone fears. Well, it's as bad as everyone fears, if not worse. Recall is part of the new, this is reading from The Verge. Recall is part of the new Copilot Plus PCs that are debuting on June 18th. But experts who have tested the feature are already warning that Recall could be a quote unquote disaster for cybersecurity. Kevin Beaumont writes, stealing everything you've ever typed or viewed on your own Windows PC is now possible with two lines of code. Cool.
And Kevin's post has a big mock Q&A about the way it's implemented. So as we said in the last show, that, or maybe it was a show before that, the people who are have not sort of mentally prepared for the idea of a feature like this by, you know, knowing about Rewind or live streams or whatever, it's just blowing their mind that something's going to be recording their screen all the time and it seems really terrible and they don't want it. And now that people see the actual implementation, yes, the implementation does have problems. But a lot of the freaking out about it is about sort of policy decisions. So one of them is that it's on by default. And apparently during like the setup process for a new PC, you can't opt out during the setup process. You have to finish the setup process and then go in settings and turn it off, right? So you can turn it off, but it's on by default and you have to hunt down the thing to do it, which is mind-boggling. Everyone has, like, all the enterprise admins for Windows PC, you know, enterprise IT people are already paranoid. I'm sure they're slamming Microsoft saying, we need a way to turn this off by default because we don't want everything recorded on our computers because during legal discovery, during lawsuits, we don't want to give a lot of information, all that stuff. And then, as you alluded to, Casey, there's the, okay, but how is it actually implemented? Some aspects of it are unavoidable. If you are recording everything that's on the screen and those recordings are accessible to the logged in user, then those recordings are accessible to the logged in user. You know what I mean? Like, people want it to be recorded, but they're like, yeah, but I don't want bad people to see it. Well, guess what? Bad people can gain access to your account as you, and then if you can see it, they can see it. So the mere existence of a treasure trove of recordings of everything you've done is in itself a security problem, no matter how quote-unquote secure it is. There's no way you can make it so secure that it can't be hacked, because then the user wouldn't be able to see it either. Like, for it to be useful, you have to be able to be, you know, go back in time and look at stuff. If you take away that ability, you can make it real secure. It's not a very useful feature, right? So that, I think, is just, that's never going to be fixed. It's just people are just going to either have to live with it and deal with it and be fine. But the second part is, okay, but you should at least make it so that other people can't see it easily. Like, it should be encrypted on disk and stuff like that. And they didn't even do that. It's like at a plain unencrypted SQLite database. Cool. It's accessible to, of course, the logged in user. Apparently, it's also accessible to any admin user on the system. It's just a plain text file. Like, they didn't even encrypt it at rest. So implementation of this does not look great, and turning it on by default does not seem great. And it's basically giving the Copilot Plus PCs kind of a marketing black eye before they have a chance to impress people with all the good things about them. You know what I mean? Like, this is not the fault of the Snapdragon X processor. This is not the fault of the hardware. It's the fault of Windows, including this feature, and turning it on by default and apparently implementing it poorly. So I don't know, Microsoft, they've got a lot of work. By the time you hear this episode, presumably Microsoft will have issued an apology and said they're not going to have it on by default and yada yada. But right now, things don't look good.
Yeah, I mean, I assume they will have it off by default before it's released, because there's way too many problems. I mean, you know, we talked about all this when Rewind AI came out, you know, whenever we talked about that, like, months ago, and then again on our overtime a couple weeks ago. You know, as you said, like, there's really no good way to have this data be, like, you know, quote, only accessible to good reasons or good people or whatever. I think as long as this data is being collected somewhere on your computer or on some service, like, whatever it is, like, even if you have it all local, all encrypted, it's still being collected. And there will be ways to exploit that. People will find security holes. Malware will try to access it. Some malware will succeed in accessing it. There are also things like legal discovery risks and things like that to, you know, that will make a lot of companies not want to do it.
And just plain old social engineering, because, again, the user can access it. So if you can convince the user to do something, like, that's most of hacking and malware is based on tricking people into doing something, right? And there's no way to collect this and have it be totally safe if the user has access to it. The user is the weakest link.
Yeah, and there are so many, like, practical and privacy concerns and just legal concerns with this. Like, I how are they getting around things like wiretapping laws? Like, there's so many problems with these kind of approaches. Like, I think it's interesting that these tools exist. They make for fantastic demos, and some people will use them and will love them. It is so far from being appropriate to be on by default. Like, that is, we are nowhere, like, it is nowhere near that universally good that it should be on by default. This should be something that, it's fine for companies like Rewind to have products that do this. It's interesting that Microsoft's doing it at the OS level now. It's wonderful to have that as an option for those, like, power productivity users who know about it, who know exactly what it's doing, and who will opt into it. It has to be only for them, though. It cannot be everyone opted in by default. That is just irresponsible.
Yeah. Not good, Bob, but here we are. AMD's next generation of AI laptop processors have been announced. Reading from The Verge, AMD announced at Computex 2024 that its next generation of Ryzen laptop processors for generative AI workloads, the Ryzen AI 300 series, it's a rebrand of its top-tier Ryzen 9 chips. The new Ryzen AI chips are built on AMD's latest architectures for neural, integrated graphics, and general processing. The first two processors in the series are the Ryzen AI 9HX 370, just rolls right off the tongue, and the similarly eloquent Ryzen AI 9365. Both have 50 trillion operations per second on their NPUs, but the HX variant is the higher end of the two. You know that because it says HX.
Yeah. So we mentioned in the last episode, or whenever we talked about the Copilot Plus PCs, that AMD, you know, and Intel also have processors that they're going to be rolling out that are going to qualify as Copilot Plus PCs. It's not just an ARM thing. So they're behind, but they're catching up. And look, there's AI right in the processor name. I'm sure they'll never regret that branding, and it won't look dated when we look back on it. But 50 tops, hey, better than 45, right? So good job, AMD.
Hooray. All right. Intel has also detailed its new Lunar Lake CPUs that will go up against the aforementioned AMD, Qualcomm, and Apple. Reading this time from Ars Technica, Lunar Lake will be Intel's first processor with a neural processing unit, or NPU, that meets Microsoft's Copilot Plus PC requirements. Intel rates Lunar Lake's NPU raw performance at 48 tops. Lunar Lake has two functional tiles. The compute tile combines all of the processor's performance and efficiency cores, the GPU, the NPU, the display outputs, and the media encoding and decoding engine. And the platform controller tile handles wired and wireless connectivity, including PCIe and USB, Thunderbolt 4, and Wi-Fi 7 and Bluetooth 5.4. Another big packaging change is that Intel is integrating RAM into the CPU package. Oh, just like Apple.
Yeah, so does this sound familiar? This is, you know, the Apple sort of led the charge here in the mass market PC for the, in the market for mass market PCs, right? They made their system on a chip. It's got the RAM in the same package. It's got the whole thing in a giant SoC. Here's Intel finally catching up with that philosophy. I think the AMD one is similar with the chiplet type thing, but this is, I really feel like this is Apple leading, and people are going to say, well, Apple wasn't the first one to do that. Lots of people have done it before, so on and so forth. But Apple showed that it can perform very well in personal computers that they sell millions of to regular people. Put it all on one chip, put the GPU on there, put the neuroprocessing, the media encoder engine, everything. And so here's Intel basically many years later saying, let's do that. Now, they have things separated. I think we've talked about this before. I think they're using like different processes for different parts of the chip. I think the connectivity thing is not built on the same 3-nanometer process or whatever. I think they might be, I forget what the details are, if they're using TSMC to fab this or whatever, but so they're taking a slightly different approach to Apple because Apple can afford to just put it on all one thing, which has some efficiency benefits, but of course it's also more costly. But it's really kind of weird to see the PC world essentially following Apple's lead and deciding, you know what, that thing Apple decided to do with the M1, we should make all our PCs like that too. Snapdragon, AMD, Intel, or all seem to be moving in that direction, at least for like the low end and medium end laptop type things. When it comes to big desktop PC and gaming PCs, they still have just giant discrete GPUs that use a ton of power and giant chips that aren't SoCs. So in that respect, they're not following Apple down that path. But boy, if I had predicted that when the M1 came out, that by the time Apple has the M4, Intel, AMD, and the ARM things will be following. I feel like that's unexpected. I would have been more likely to think, oh, maybe the whole PC world will go ARM, as discussed in past episode. Doesn't look like they're all going ARM, especially since the Copilot Plus PC thing isn't firing off like gangbusters. But I'm still holding out hope. And anyway, in the meantime, Intel and AMD are in the game too.
Yeah, they are. Speaking of Apple and M chips, Apple says the M2 iPad Air, no, it doesn't have 10 GPU cores. We actually meant 9. Cool. We're cool, right? Reading from Mac Rumors, Apple has seemingly updated its tech specs webpage for the latest M2 iPad Air models to indicate the M2 chip has a 9-core GPU rather than 10 cores, as previously stated. The change was first reported by 9to5Mac. Based on available web snapshots, the update to Apple's U.S. website was made within the last 10 days. This was written 2 days ago as we record. However, the equivalent webpage on many of Apple's regional stores still lists the M2 iPad Air as having a 10-core GPU. Eventually, a statement was provided to 9to5Mac, and Apple said that the details it shared with the iPad Air's performance were always based on a 9-core GPU. So Apple said, and I'm quoting, "We are updating Apple.com to correct the core count for the M2 iPad Air. All the performance claims for the M2 iPad Air are accurate and based on a 9-core GPU." What's it, Upsies?
What a weird flub. Like, yeah. It doesn't even seem like it's a last-minute decision. This is something that had to have been decided long ago, but, like, maybe there was a miscommunication. Like, they decided to go with the 9-core instead of the 10-core to save money on the iPad Air, and just the web team didn't hear about it, even though that decision was made 4 months ago. Like, it's not like they started manufacturing the iPad Air on the day of the announcement or something. Very strange. Not a big deal for the iPad Air. That's fine, but I don't know what's going on over there.
Yep, it's a little weird. Let's talk about LLMs and how they can learn. Adeco writes, there's some quote-unquote new tech that aims to enable LLMs to learn in context in production, avoiding the limitations of relying solely on RAG, or Retrieval Augmented Generation. While promising, this approach is significantly more expensive. Here's a paper explaining, and we'll put it in the show notes, the methodology from earlier this year and a video discussing the current limitations you mentioned on the episode and a potential solution that is clearly explained. So we'll put all three of these links in the show notes. John, care to summarize and or dissect for us?
Yeah, so there's one video that says, what is RAG? What is Retrieval Augmented Generation? And my summary of it would be, you take what the person typed into their chatbot and you stick a bunch of text in front of it. And then you send that to the chatbot, and picking the text you stick in front of it, they're not actually doing this, but like you can imagine if they ask some question about cars, you would do a Google search based on what they asked and take the results of that Google search and stick it to the front of their text, and then take that whole wad of text and throw it through the LLM, right? it's, you know, it's taking more than what you said, but trying to augment it with some context. Okay, LLM, maybe you weren't trained on any data about cars, but I'm going to pull the latest up-to-date information about the car they mentioned in their prompt, and I'm going to put that in front of their prompt, and then I'm going to shove all that text, their question, plus all the text I grabbed about the latest cars, and I'm going to chuck that into the LLM, because, you know, the LLMs are like, oh, I don't know anything after 2021, right? Like, or the old versions of ChatGPT would say that because they were trained on older data. Well, what if someone's asking about something that's more recent that the LLM could not have been trained on, or maybe just wasn't trained on because it's really narrow interest? That's what RAG is, right? But of course, that has lots of limitations. We'll put the second video says, what are the limitations of RAG? And you learn all about that. And then the final thing is continual learning for large language models, the paper, the scientific paper that we'll link. And this is the, I think, from the abstract. It says, large language models are not amenable to frequent retraining due to high training costs arising from their massive scale. However, updates are necessary to endow LLMs with new skills and keep them up to date with rapidly evolving human knowledge. This paper surveys recent work on continual learning for LLMs, right? So the idea is, you know, what we said before, when you throw things through an LLM, the weights, the little numbers inside the LLM don't change, right? They take input, they produce output, but the inside of that LLM never changes. So you can't teach it anything. All you can do is make your prompt bigger and bigger and hope that the information in your prompt influences the answer. And it does influence the answer, but not as much as training the LLM on a whole bunch of that information. You know? Anyway, so that's RAG.
Right. So then Stephen Tierney writes that Sundar Pichai's infinite context window claim from Google I.O. seems to stem from this paper, which is entitled Leave No Context Behind, Efficient Infinite Context Transformers with Infinite Attention. This work introduces an efficient method to scale transformer-based large language models to infinitely long inputs with bounded memory and computation. A key component in our proposed approach is a new attention technique that incorporates a compressive memory into the vanilla attention mechanism. The attention mechanism in transformers exhibits quadratic complexity in both memory footprint and computation time. Compressive memory systems promise to be more scalable and efficient for extremely long sequences. Instead of using an array that grows with the input sequence length, a compressive memory primarily maintains a fixed number of parameters to store and recall information with a bounded storage and computation cost. In the compressive memory, new information is added to the memory by changing its parameters with an objective that this information can be recovered back later on. John, translate that for me, please.
So the scaling thing, for people who ever took computer science class with big O notation, is like, how does this algorithm scale with the size of the input? For example, linear scaling would be, if you ask me to process 20 of these things, I take twice as long as if you ask me to process 10, right? That's linear scaling. You can have other kinds of scaling where it scales to the square of the input, and that's worse. Right. And, you know, quadratic, like that's what they're getting at there. The point is, if you make longer and longer inputs to the LLM, the time goes like a hockey stick graph. It gets really, really bad. It doesn't even scale linearly. And even linear would be bad because Sundar Pichai was saying you can have infinite context. We have a limitation now of like 2 million tokens, and that's pretty good. You can put a large wad of text through our LLM. Pretty big, right? But you can't, like I was mentioning, like the infinite context opened the door to the idea of like, can you actually teach an LLM? Well, if your context is infinite, you can just keep typing stuff until the LLM gets it. No LLM. Let me tell you more about this thing. And let me tell you more. Like, essentially, you're not training it. You're not changing the weights. But it's like, anytime I type anything, you know, the last billion characters I've written to it over the past 5 years get sent through the LLM, plus the question I just asked stuck at the end. And that's, as you can imagine, incredibly inefficient because of the way it scales. So this infinite context thing is like, well, we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to use this thing where we kind of like, we try to do with a fixed amount of memory and computation. And I don't understand how they're doing it, but it's like, I feel like they have some sort of block that the input goes into, and then it modifies the values in that block. And it just keeps doing that over and over again. And finally it gets the final block and sends that through the LLM after it's been modified by all the input. But it's much less compelling. Like many people who wrote in about this is like, yeah, it's not really infinite context. It's more like taking an infinite amount of input and squishing it down to a small finite size and sending that through the LLM and hoping you've preserved enough information to get a useful answer out of it. And by the way, the other thing, the previous link about the continual learning is that some people are looking into the idea of what if we did change the weights when you sent a question or something through? If you talk to an LLM and you try to tell it something, can we retrain based on what you put in and change the weights of the model? And that's, you know, an area of research or whatever. And as I mentioned, we talked about this earlier, that opens the door for people to screw up the LLMs and make them terrible, right? You could tell it a whole bunch of bogus stuff, and now your LM just gets dumber and worse and tells more lies, right? It's like children, right? You can teach them whatever you want, right? You hope you teach them good things and teach them how to read and write and, you know, do math correctly and all, and be a nice, polite person or whatever, and what you will get out of all that effort is hopefully a good adult, right? But if you are terrible to them and do terrible things and tell them lies, the results will be worse, right? So the ability of, as you can imagine, if you allowed anyone on the internet to type anything they want that would actually change your LLM, that would be bad instantly. we already saw that with the non-trainable LLMs. Remember when Microsoft put their chatbot up and it was like spewing Nazi stuff? That's just because it's trained on the internet and it's filled with all sorts of terrible things. So they're trying to tamp that down. But this would be like, no, it will be retrained based on the things you tell it. Nightmare fuel. But of course, if you had your own independent LLM and you were sensible, then you could mess up yours and other people would have their own and they could mess up theirs. And you know, it's an interesting idea, but the infinite contact one, it was like, no, the LLM doesn't change until we release a new version. The weights are unchangeable, but we'll allow you to type an infinite amount of information in your prompt and maybe let them make it do something sensible. None of these approaches seem super great to me, but I'm glad people are trying to figure out how to get around the current limitations, because the current limitations are crippling for some use cases. Like, they just basically make it impossible to do certain things reliably. Doesn't mean they're not useful. They're useful for other things, but certain use cases, it becomes completely useless. So I will look forward to this research advancing. But when it's appearing in scientific papers and stuff, it makes me think it's many years from being practically implemented. But we'll see.
All right. As we sit here, it is the evening of Wednesday the 5th. And in just a few short days, we will all be flying west to the greater San Jose area in order to go to WWDC, Apple's annual Worldwide Developer Conference. As we mentioned last episode, all three of us will be there, barring any plane catastrophes. And I know all three of us are super excited.
Why do you have to say that, Casey? Hey,
you know what? You never know what will happen. So I just mean like a delay, for the record. I didn't mean
that's
that
not what it sounded like.
Please.
Sorry.
Okay.
It's not getting any better. Don't worry. We'll fix it in post. So WWDC is coming up. And so we should probably talk about what to expect. And honestly, I'm very surprised, well, maybe not surprised, but impressed with the lack of like concrete leaks. And let me go through a few things here, unless one of you has an opening statement. Let me go through a few things that we haven't really talked about that we can use as jumping off points. But by and large, I feel like it's pretty well under lock and key what we're going to see.
Why do you think that? It's just because the things we've talked about have been rumored. I believe most of the things will come to pass, and I think that's what they're going to show. But we'll see. We'll go through the items we have here. We've talked about a lot of things on past episodes that have been rumored for WWDC, and I don't think many of them have been debunked. They're just sitting out there waiting to see if they're true or not.
Yeah. So we'll start. Mark Gurman has said, read my lips, no new hardware. And so there's apparently not going to be any hardware this year, which I don't think is particularly surprising, but Mark has stated it is definitely not happening.
Yeah, that sometimes happens. We have the no hardware WWDC. Sometimes Apple itself kind of leaks it to control expectations. In this case, I don't think there were any particular expectations that Apple needed to leak to tamp down, other than my unrealistic expectations about the Mac Pro and the Mac Studio. But, you know, there's
my
cold water on
that. Siri not sucking.
But no hardware. No hardware WWDC. And, you know, we just had a bunch of hardware. There's the only hardware that Apple should be updating right now are the ones they apparently can't update because the chips aren't ready, and that would be the Mac Studio and the Mac Pro. I mean, you know, he was pretty definitive, and when he comes out this close to WWDC and says no hardware, I just have to accept there's going to be no hardware. So I'm sad about it, but perhaps not surprising.
You know, let me jump in and go a little off script here. Do you think, John, that this is the year that the forthcoming macOS release, whatever it may be called, do you think that's the year that they start really hammering down or, you know, like taking away stuff for Intel? Because you aren't missing out on much on your ancient ass Mac Pro, right?
Performance.
I can't remember all the things.
Well done, Marco.
Yeah, but didn't we talk about this? Like, what year we thought the macOS would stop? I forget what I predicted, but whatever I predicted back then, I stick by because I think that was probably a reasonable prediction. Maybe this year. I don't know. I feel like it's a little bit early, but you know, we'll see. Like, here's half the reason I think it's not going to come this year is because that would require extra work by Apple to deal with that. And they're like, macOS, do we really want to put that much effort in? Let's do it next year.
Fair enough. All right. So speaking of macOS and also iOS, allegedly, according to Mark Gurman, the Settings app is getting revamped with a cleaner interface, better organization, and much improved search. And that's both iOS and macOS. Like I said, I'll believe it when I see it, insofar as I don't doubt that they've touched and maybe rejiggered some stuff in Settings. But I don't know. I am not as offended by Settings as most people, but I can absolutely tell you it is a mess. And although I haven't looked at it in a little while, I feel like they've kind of given a hint about this on the Vision Pro, because the Vision Pro settings are vastly different than any other platform. And it, to my recollection, they do make a modicum of sense in there. So maybe we'll see, you know, that getting cribbed and put into iOS and macOS. But one way or another, we're going to get something different.
Yeah, this rumor doesn't have enough detail to be that interesting, either because it's just a vague rumor and they don't have details, or because the person conveying this rumor doesn't understand what's wrong with Settings. Right? They just say, "I was revamped to get a cleaner interface." I don't think the complaints were that the interface was not clean, right? Like, I mean, I think back when Settings first came out, or whatever version came out. Yeah, Jason had a good article of like, look, you can use hierarchy to arrange information visually and conceptually, and that can find, make things easier to find, and just there's we don't want to relitigate everything that's wrong with Settings, but like there's no concrete things about what are they fixing. They're like, oh well, they're just rearranging stuff, some things, they're putting things in different places, and the search will be better. Those are all good, like improvements are welcome, but I haven't seen anyone say they're totally overhauling it and it's going to be good now. It's like minor improvements, and you know, I guess if you do minor improvements many years repeatedly, you'll get better and better and it'll be fine, but I'm still not jazzed about the setting up.
I mean, it's still full of bugs even. Like, setting aside the design, which is, I think, still poor, I don't really necessarily need them to massively revamp the design if it's still going to be this buggy. Like, if they only do one thing to improve it, I'd rather they make the current design actually work correctly. But that being said, you know, a new design would also be welcome. But I'm hoping whatever this rumor is, I'm hoping that what they're really saying is, it's been worked on a lot, and maybe that will include some bug fixes also. But it still feels like a broken web app version of something that's trying to imitate an iOS setting screen. Like it does not feel like anything that would ever have come from Apple if you would have shown people, like, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago, like, hey, this is current Apple software in the year 2024. They would look at it like, are you serious?
So yeah, we're talking about macOS settings, but this rumor is actually primarily about iOS settings, which, you know, we all are familiar with and doesn't need as much attention as macOS settings, but I think they're rearranging stuff, splitting out some things that were previously combined. iOS settings, the search has had many years of work in it, so that's how a lot of us navigate settings, because you can't remember exactly where something is. But, you know, in all cases, I feel like, you know, the general philosophy of settings in both macOS and iOS is being maintained to be the same. They're just like, maybe we could arrange things better. And I think on iOS, the design is reasonable. On macOS, they should have better information organization and hierarchy given the larger size of the screens and the more sophisticated input methods. And as for the bugs, we said this before when Settings was first redesigned, how much of it is the Settings app? How much of it is Swift UI bugs, you know? I mean, I know it's all the same company and they can complain directly to the Swift UI people, but when stuff like text fields like don't stay editable or lose focus when you're in the middle of typing, I wonder about that. And sometimes they're using like quote unquote standard controls that I think are bad standard controls. The Settings team didn't define those controls. They're using the standard controls as part of this form thing in Swift UI. And I think those controls are bad. I think they look bad. I think they don't work well. But the Settings team didn't make those, right? They're just, you know, using the OS level controls. So to the extent that they're buggy, I think a lot of it is probably on the Frameworks teams. And to the extent that those controls are bad, that's all on the Frameworks team. Like, one of the things that drives me up a wall, and I just can't believe this is not, I guess it's in Settings, but you know the passwords pane in Settings when you edit like a password and it makes you edit text in like a right aligned thing. I feel like I'm writing in a right to left language, or left to whatever the opposite of the way English is.
Right to left.
Have you done this and seen it? It breaks my brain how like backspacing and forward spacing and moving text goes. you're editing right aligned text for like the password. I don't want any surprises or unexpected behaviors when I'm editing the text of a password in plain text, right? Just, that's not a good way to let me edit information. It's name value pairs, username, password, website. Don't make it right aligned in a text field that has no borders, that's the same color as the background, that just behaves in bizarre ways. that's the stuff that really needs to be fixed. And the settings team, well, maybe for the ride-along thing, they have control over that, but I'm not sure how much control the settings team has over that. So,
well, yeah, but this is, I mean, you know, this is like maybe not their fault, but it is their problem. You know, yes, they were, you know, they were building this app on what seems to have been, you know, definitely a shaky design concept of let's just make it look like iOS, and then, you know, that didn't go so well. Building it on top of Swift UI for Mac, which is, you know, not the greatest platform for Swift UI to date so far, and. But, you know, at the same time, like, nobody was forcing them to do this. Nobody was, or at least, you know, the Swift UI team doesn't run the company. So the Swift UI team was not forcing the rest of the company to say, hey, you better rewrite all your stuff in Swift UI right now. And even if they were, that's not our problem as the customers. Like, this is a self-created problem internally to Apple. So what we see, we don't care what it's written in. We don't care what team dynamics there were or what they wanted to do on a technical level to make it more idealistic. All we see is the settings app is really weird and sucks now. Like, and it, you know, granted it was not in perfect shape before, but it's bad now, and it looks like they did a whole bunch of work and came out with something that was just still very bad, just in new and different ways. And you know, the example you gave with like the typing in a right aligned text field, like, so much of what I see in the settings app feels like no one has ever used it. Like, I feel like I'm trying out some code that I just wrote for the first time, and I'm running it in the simulator, and I'm trying it out, and like, oh, this doesn't work. Okay, back to the drawing board. But they shipped it that way. Like, all, like, it just seems like it's like a design concept that they showed in a meeting one day, and someone hit the wrong button and shipped it.
Yeah. Yep. And the thing is, the reason I think they're sticking with design, it did solve a bunch of the problems they had with like the old fixed layout. Like, if the old fixed layout just wasn't scalable, you couldn't add more stuff easily. Everything was sort of hand laid out, and it was hand laid out over like a decade and a half by different people. So you could sort of see the different one preference pane was different than another based on when it was made and who made it and what they decided to do and what mood they were in. And this is uniform and scalable and scrollable and extensible. But the building blocks that they use to achieve that, they're bad building blocks, right? The individual controls, the way it scales, the way it looks, the way it works, that's all bad. So they did solve their problem. Hey, now we have a scalable solution for settings in macOS. But they've brought on themselves, to your point, Marco, many new problems by using these new controls that either weren't ready or buggy or just bad ideas. And that is a shame. So we'll see. I welcome any kind of improvement, but there is no rumor that it's a complete overhaul that adds information hierarchy and visual hierarchy and restores some of the hand laid out things for the most common controls. Cause that's what they should really do. Like the old hand laid out one, like the good ones, the nice preference panes that were hand laid out and beautiful, they were nice and easy to use. And you could remember what they look like and you could remember where controls were spatially. And it was like being in a place in a room with furniture arranged and all my wonderful things that I love, but it was just nice. Right. And you can't do that for every single one. So you do need a scalable solution for more settings, right? You got to have that, and they should have a better system. But for the most commonly used screen, like the five most commonly used setting screens, and I'm sure Apple knows what those are, hand lay them out. Bring in an actual good UI designer who remembers what Mac user interface is supposed to look like. Hell, bring someone who's ever used a web form, because I can't remember any time I was asked to like update my passport on a web page and the text field was right aligned in English. Doesn't make any sense. Who thought of that? Or the labels were like massively far away from the values. Just disappointing.
Yeah, it's an adventure in there, but we'll see what happens. VisionOS 2.0. There haven't been very many rumors about this. Somebody pointed out, I don't have the toot in front of me, but somebody pointed out that, hey, VisionOS shipped, you know, in the middle of the software life cycle for Apple. And so it would not be surprising if VisionOS 2.0 is really just getting all the low-hanging fruit that didn't ship for 1.0. But one of the things that's been rumored maybe is that some or perhaps even all of Apple's iPad apps that are running in compatibility mode on the Vision Pro, perhaps those will become real, honest-to-goodness Vision Pro apps. So things like Home, Calendar, Podcast, Pages, etc., which I think is possible, although it would not surprise me if that was issued in favor of doing something more whiz bang, but we'll see. Maybe we would be able to rearrange the home screen. That'd be cool.
Yeah. So if these apps, if the things that shipped as iPad apps are native, it makes me think that they were already being developed. They just weren't ready for launch, right? Because I don't feel like they would launch the Vision Pro and then say, okay, now all those things we had to ship as iPad apps, let's get teams on those to make them. Like, seems like they would have to be in progress already and just didn't make the deadline. But either way, it is embarrassing when you launch a new platform and a whole bunch of your really important apps are the iPad versions. But, you know, Apple has done that in the past, like with the iPad, not getting versions of Apple's own Pro apps for years and years and years. Sometimes it takes Apple a really long time to get around to doing stuff. And it was the iPad OS rumor that's going to get a calculator now. It's just they just never got around to it, right? And so, I mean, if they do this, at least it shows if all the iPad apps are now native, I think that does show some level of commitment that they realized it was embarrassing not to have that, and it was just a timing thing, and now they're, you know, fixing that. But I agree with you, Casey, that I don't expect VisionOS 2.0 to be massively different. There's just so many obvious things they need to fix and enhance, fix bugs, add minor features. I don't even expect them to have a big home screen rearranging thing. If they do, it'll be very rudimentary, because this is really just kind of like the, you know, make it what we wish 1.0 could have been if we had an extra, you know, 6 months.
Yeah, because that's really all it's been. Like, you know, you think about every year, you think about these platforms going up by one whole version number and there being a certain kind of minimum amount of improvement. But keep in mind, like, Vision Pro was a half-year release. And so it really hasn't been that long since 1.0. And from all we've heard, it seems like software was the like gating factor of when it could be released, not hardware. So like it's not like they have a bunch of software work saved up for years, you know, waiting to be released. Like, no, you know, what we got so far, like that's what they have so far. And so I'm not expecting a lot of movement on the Vision Pro software side yet. It's too soon. And that being said, like, keep in mind too, this is a very like distant forward looking platform for them. This is not going to be a big seller for a long time, if ever. And so I think the level of improvement to expect for VisionOS releases, even going forward, even when they have full years to do it, I'm expecting something more like watchOS releases or tvOS releases. Like, I'm not expecting like major new changes and major new features to be coming out every single year. I think it's going to be a slower update pace. Like, I think this is a very long game they're playing with Vision Pro. I think, honestly, I would love to see them step on the gas a lot harder, but what we're seeing so far shows a different strategy. But regardless, I don't expect a lot of movement on this platform every single year. I think it's going to be a very slow burn.
Well, you get that immersive environment for working in Xcode with the wavy neon lines and stuff?
Oh, yeah, from the developer app.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool. I guess I actually haven't tried this out yet, but that's a thing, which is neat. But yeah, I don't know. I would love to see, even before I see a lot of software motion on VisionOS, I really would prefer to just see content more than anything else. Like, that's what I feel like I want. And we're just not getting it right now, which is too bad. But, you know, it is what it is. I will say, though, I was briefly using the Vision Pro using the Mac virtual display mode with the developer strap on, with a high-speed USB cable plugged into my Mac. And I do really like that. I mean, I was at home, so I only needed it for a minute or two because I was working on something. But it is pretty cool when it works, particularly when it's done via a cable, because then latency is much, much lower, and I feel like the crispness of the display is also considerably better, which I enjoy. But yeah, I mean, I just want content. Give me more content, because I'm not using this thing for work a whole heck of a lot. I'm not sure anyone really is. So I would really just love more content.
Yeah, and that would also, I think, significantly drive sales too. Like, that's what we need first, because you're right. Like, it's going to be a long time before there's meaningful software on here, if ever. So again, like Apple TV, like this, when we had gone to the thing in November that we can't talk about, the one thing I was dying to talk about in the intervening months between that and release was, it was very obvious to me, even from some past time, it was very obvious to me that this feels like computing on a virtual Apple TV with an infinitely sized screen. And like it does kind of physically feel like you are kind of manipulating these giant apps in your giant space with these kind of indirect mechanisms of like your eyes and pinching and flinging things around and stuff like that. And it kind of like it felt a lot like computing on an Apple TV, but just in a much bigger way. And obviously better in some ways, worse in others. But like for the most part, it felt like it was closer to that than using a laptop or an iPad or something like that. And so I think what I would expect here is I think it's going to end up being a lot like the Apple TV as an app platform, which is most apps will not find much reason to be there, and most users won't want to use most apps there. But with the right content and with the right specialized apps, this could be something people use frequently. It just needs that content to be there. Like, I never even think about making an Apple TV app, but I use my Apple TV almost every day. Like, that's and what do I use on my Apple TV? Like, four apps. But I use them almost every day. Right? So yep. The Vision Pro, I think, could be there. I think it could reach that point where people are using it for mostly content consumption and maybe occasional specialized uses or like very kind of narrow, you know, productivity uses for certain people. I see that being possible, but I think to get there first, we need the install base to grow, and the only thing that's really going to meaningfully grow it, I think, at this point is content. So that's what I'm really watching for, is like, where are the content deals? Where's the content coming from? Like, how much can there be? How quickly? That's what will actually move these things. And then we can talk about computing possibilities down the road.
Yeah. But I tell you what, if you are traveling and want a huge-ass screen that doesn't take a whole lot of space, it is without peer. So there are some uses, as you know, few and far between as they may be. OpenAI. According to Mark Gurman, Apple picked OpenAI as its inaugural AI partner for a few reasons. It got better business terms than Google was offering, and Apple believes that OpenAI's technology is the best available on the market. Apple is expected to offer its new AI features as an opt-in service, according to people familiar with the matter. So, yeah, I think everyone's expecting the AI dust to be sprinkled all over the place. It's yet to be seen if somebody in the C-suite got a burr up their butt to put AI on everything, or if Apple will take what I hope, if Apple does what I hope they'll do, which is take a more mature approach and ask, where are we actually helping? You know, let's not do this just because we can. Let's do it because we should. And honestly, I think that there's far fewer places that AI should be used than where AI can be used. And we'll see what happens. But I'm hopeful they're going to be mature about it.
I was looking at this Gurman article. I'm doing the search for the Bloomberg style guide says when you are attributing anonymous sources, you have to say the people said, right? Mm-hmm. So you just search for the people, that string, because that'll find you the tidbits that he's saying are sourced. My sources say this. Mm-hmm. And everything you read there was one of those the people said things. So I removed that text from the some of the snippets because it's awkward. Anyway. The reasons for picking, it was they were talking to Google and other partners or whatever. The Apple thinks that they're the best, that they're the market leader, and that they gave better business terms to Google, which kind of makes sense because OpenAI is younger and hungrier. You know what I mean? The OpenAI thing is interesting because everything you said about the AI features, right? We assume that there'll be a bunch of those, like, oh, you can now do a useful thing, and yeah, we'll say it's AI or whatever, but it's the same stuff we used to say that was ML, right? But the chatbot style, hey, you talk to an LLM as if it's like a little person back and forth. All the OpenAI rumors are like, that's what OpenAI would be providing because Apple has an internal one that they're working on. They have their own kind of LLM chatbot named Ajax or whatever, but it's not ready and OpenAI's things are better. So let's do a deal with them. But I still like the fact that it would be opt-in, like, what does that mean? Does that mean that when you're setting up your computer and says, oh, and by the way, we have a partnership in OpenAI, do you want to enable feature that puts, like, an icon in your menu bar that you can click on that props up a text box and now you're talking to ChatGPT or something? Like, what is opting into this? How does a chatbot fit into the OS? We can see how all the other stuff fits in. And again, like we said last week, the rumors that come down from on high that's telling every single team, find a place to put AI into your product, that's bad and that's, you know, kind of the worst of corporate, like, oh, it's a buzzword, let's just find a place to shoehorn this into our product. But I to some degree, I trust the product teams to think, what can we do with AI that is useful in the Notes app, in Pages, in the Finder? Like, I don't think any of them are going to be like, I know how we can use AI in our app. Let's put a text box up and they'll send the message to ChatGPT. Like, they'll think of something better, right? It's bad that they're asking all teams to do that because maybe it doesn't make sense to some teams to add AI features, but the mandate, we keep seeing this rumor that the mandate came down from on high. Every team, you better find some way to add AI because this is the AI year, right? But that is entirely separate from this OpenAI deal, which is like, oh, you can opt in somehow in macOS or in iOS to Like, on iOS, does it just install the ChatGPT app? Like, what does this mean? This is the thing that is I'm looking for the most in this presentation. That they're going to be on stage. They're going to say, we've partnered with OpenAI, or maybe they won't say that. And somehow, some way, they're going to say, in our operating systems that we're shipping, there's a way for you to start talking to ChatGPT and having a little conversation in a little window somewhere. I don't even think that's that useful a feature. There's already a ChatGPT app. There's a Mac one with Swift UI. There's a native iOS one. You can use it on the web. Like, what is this? I don't get it. And this is the thing that's baffling me because, as we said, I think this is the highest potential for badness because it is such a non-Apple, non-controlled, non-careful, just like Wild West, talk to ChatGPT. Good luck. It's not our thing. Right? How is that a selling point? How are you going to promote that as like a new feature of your operating systems? In a non-hardware WWDC, I don't think there's probably going to be a developer story unless Apple's going to like pay for your API tokens and now you can write an iOS or a Mac app and use their framework and get free access to ChatGPT because Apple did some multi-million dollar deal with them or something. This baffles me. That's why I added this thing of the whole opt-in. Like, what does that mean? What are we opting into? What are you providing? I have red flags all over this.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm so turned off by Sam Altman and OpenAI. I don't know. It's funny. The dude who we all snickered about wearing, you know, the two popped collar polo shirts. Wasn't that WWDC forever and a day ago?
A long time ago. Yeah.
And we all laughed and had a good, you know, laugh at his expense. And, you know, oh, look at this Silicon Valley bro just being the world's broiest bro.
Fast forward 5, 10 years,
it seems like same as it ever was. Nothing's ever really changed. Like, it's, you know, move fast, break things and have no consequences. And I don't know. Like, again, we'll see what happens. Like, I am cautiously optimistic. And again, I like to think of Apple as generally one of the more mature and adult organizations in the Valley. I'm sure there's exceptions. I'm sure that's not always true, but broadly, I think that to be the case.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. I so desperately want Apple to be deliberate, be considered, be mature, and not just put the AI at dust on everything they see. But hey, we'll see.
I mean, I find ChatGPT useful. I use it in my rotation of things that I do. I do all the chatbots. I do Google searches. I get useful things out of it. There is use to be had there, but I'm doing that already. Like, I don't need Apple to add any features to macOS for me to do this. I can have a free account on OpenAI. I can have a paid one. I can use Google Gemini. I can do it on iOS. I can do it on macOS. Like, all of that is already there. I don't think I need any kind of OS integration to make that experience better. I can open a web page. I can have, you know, let's be honest, it's already open in a tab somewhere, right? It's not, like, you know, maybe it's not on my phone or whatever. Like, I guess they could use voice thing. Like, it integrates with Siri and you talk to Siri and it sends it out. Like, I'm not saying there's no room for OS integration. There is, but this just seems such an uneasy partnership. But also because, you know, like the sources in this essentially seem to indicate some of the sources are not inside the Apple. Sometimes they're ex-Apple people or whatever. But like that, this is a stopgap. Apple doesn't have anything ChatGPT caliber. They don't have anything Google Gemini caliber. They want to have something like that. They want to have a story for that for WWDC. Therefore, they have to partner. We talked about this before. But they are working on stuff. Apple does have its own internal LLM. It does have its own internal chatbot that its own employees have been using. It's just not up to snuff yet, which makes sense because they got a late start, right? But they're doing research in that area. So presumably, if this turns out to be useful, Apple would want to pull a Google Maps here and say, yeah, we'll partner with this other company because they're the market leader. But eventually, we'll roll out our own thing. And eventually, our own thing will be, if not better, then good enough, right? And hopefully they'll do it better than they did with Maps rollout, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. But still, like, this is what I'm looking at the most, of like, what's the pitch here? How is it integrated? How is this presented? If it's opt-in, like, what does that look like? Like, it's so weird to sort of, if this ends up being a tentpole feature and not just, like, an off-to-the-side, because I can imagine just being like, oh, and by the way, we partnered with them and blah, 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 and that's all they say about it. It's, like, quick, right? But if this is a tentpole feature, usually tentpole features aren't like, and we're so confident in it that it's not on by default. It's kind of like the Microsoft, the Windows recall thing, right? That's a sign of something like, we think it might be okay, but there is some danger here. So if you just hit, you know, okay, okay, okay during setup, whatever we're doing, you won't be exposed to, right? But if you opt into it somehow, then, you know, again, when you talk to Siri and it can't figure out the answer, instead of telling you to check the web, it'll ask ChatGPT or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, that's all the items that we had in the show notes. I really don't know what to expect. And I am so very, very interested to see what the AI story is. It seems that Apple's previous dedication to ML or machine learning, as we've talked about in many other shows and blogs have talked about, you know, they finally embraced AI as a term. And so we'll see what happens. I think it's tough because, you know, Apple is a publicly held company and publicly traded company. And, you know, I think investors and you know, rank and file shareholders are going to expect them to have that AI dust sprinkled everywhere, you know, like a graffiti cannon of or not graffiti, a glitter cannon of AI dust just shooting all over, you know, everything WWDC touches. But I don't know that that's appropriate or reasonable. So we'll see what happens. And I'm just curious to see, you know, now that we've got a whole new platform, I'm so excited to see what VisionOS 2 is. If history tells us anything, it will be disappointing.
Do you think VisionOS will have AI dust sprinkled on it?
Oh, no.
At all? Anywhere?
I'd be surprised if iPadOS even has it. Like, keep in mind, like, you know, again, we're still dealing with Apple's kind of hierarchy of platform importance. iOS is going to get all the cool stuff first. And that's, I would be surprised if we see it anywhere else. I think it's going to be iOS certainly, you know, first, and then maybe they'll put some of the basics into
The cross-platform stuff will get it. Like the whole like removing people from the background of photos, that's just going to be everywhere because it's a common framework. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course, yeah. But like, you know, in terms of like features like specific to say like the Vision Pro or the Watch or like I would be surprised to see anything like that soon.
And speaking of like sprinkling AI sparkles everywhere and how everyone expects it to do it, at this point, though, and this is what everyone expects, but at this point, it's true that the only way for Apple to really make news is to do something different than everyone else does. I mean, they can make news by saying we're not doing any AI stuff, and that would be news, but that's obviously not what they're doing, right? But they're not going to do what every other company did, which is like, AI everywhere, sprinkle, 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 like, you know, and because that looks like everyone else did that, like, you know, throwing spaghetti against the wall, right? Like Windows did. So anything we could think of, we're just going to do. The only way Apple can actually make news is by saying, we're doing AI, but we're doing it the Apple way, where everything is useful and blah, blah, blah. Like, they have to present it that way. That is a marketing decision. We already know they're already doing that. We talked about that last week. There's tons of features that they used to call ML that are just features of our phone, right? If they do that this year and they present it as, we're not doing AI like everyone else, we're not throwing spaghetti against it, we don't have a thing where you draw a picture and AI draws along with you because we didn't think that was that useful yet. So we didn't put it in. Right? That's the story. That's the Apple story. And the news would be Apple, WWDC, rolls out a bunch of AI features, but unlike other people's AI features, they only introduce the ones that are useful. And also a ChatGPT thing. Right? Because that's the wild card, but I don't understand that, right? That is the way to make news. Otherwise, the story will be Apple catches up with everyone else and does what everyone else has already done. Which is, you know, I guess better than the bad story, which is Apple doesn't do any AI stuff and they're doomed. Right?
Well, I mean, I think that's the most likely. Like, I think by far the most likely reaction by the overall press and, you know, business and Wall Street communities is going to be they didn't do enough. Now, you know, as actual Apple users, for me, you know, like what you were saying earlier, like I would rather they do things that are useful to me. I don't need them to do the most stupid things with AI, because other companies will gladly do the most stupid things with AI. Apple doesn't need to do that. You know, as you're saying, like they are like the more grown up company. Like I don't think that is their style to be like the spaghetti against the wall, cutting edge. Like, let's do a bunch of stupid stuff. Like, that's not Apple style. Apple is very conservative in that kind of approach. And you know, to some degree, that's kind of just in their DNA. To another degree, that they need to be because they have much more scrutiny on them, and their moves have, you know, they make bigger waves.
And their brand, it's kind of not that they're Disney, but their brand is very kind of like, let's not be hasty and do the radical stuff just because everyone else is doing it, right? And I honestly think if they market this well, the story won't be Apple didn't do enough. The story will be what Apple wants it to be, is that Apple took a more considered approach. Everyone else has just been like, AI, and Apple, you know, made all their features useful. Here are the things that it does. It only does things that are provably useful, right? Kind of like they did last year and the year before and the year before. Like, oh, and OS-wide, you can OCR text. Like, that's an AI feature, but it's useful. Like, and it's not if that is the story Apple presents, I think most of the stories from outlets that don't have it in for Apple will be Apple decides to take a different approach to AI. Unlike its competitors, Apple says that it's only rolling out features that are provably useful. They're not going to use that term because that's not a good marketing term. But, you know, some marketing person will come up with a 2 or 3 word phrase that distinguishes Apple's approach to AI, which, again, is going to be no different than what they did last year. The only difference is the magic of marketing, right? And I, you know, you're right that there will be some stories like Apple's not doing enough. They're falling behind. Microsoft has 40 LLMs running in the background in Windows 11, right? But I feel like when the whole Windows Copilot PC thing is just so wrapped up in the recall disaster that no one is even talking about the draw along or whatever, or the OS-wide like translation, which I think actually is useful. So the door is open for Apple to do something smart here. And again, the wild card is what the hell is OpenAI? Because OpenAI is not that. OpenAI and ChatGPT, that is not, we only do the things that we are sure are useful and safe. Because, you know, for all the uses that ChatGPT has, it's not conservative. It's the basically the floodgates. It's like, type anything you want. Hope it works. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, like that. I would be very happy with, take most of the basics that we already know that, quote, AI stuff can do. Even take a lot of the stuff the phones already do and just make it better. Make it more reliable. Give it better results. As we were saying last episode, like basic, you know, dictation, like text to, or speech to text kind of APIs. You know, like I believe, is it all Android phones or just the Pixel phones that have supported like system-wide closed captioning? You can just have like constant transcription showing on screen of whatever audio is playing on the phone.
Like we added to Windows.
Right. Like why haven't iPhones been able to do that yet? Like that's such low-hanging fruit for Apple. Like that should be a feature. Of course it should be a feature. And that's, again, things like removing people from photos that shouldn't be there, or, you know, like that kind of stuff. These are not cutting-edge new ideas. These are features that the rest of the industry has done. And yes, Apple will be playing, quote, catch-up, but that's fine as long as they do a good job of it. The reason why some of these features stand out to us as things Apple should do is because they are good ideas. We are not saying Apple should do everything everyone else has done. Most of the other things people have done with, quote, AI are weird and useless and creepy or something. But there are a few really cool killer features that it would be nice if Apple had good versions of. And then beyond that, what we've already talked about, things like, obviously the big one is make Siri better. Like that is the big one. Please, for the love of God, make Siri better.
It's interesting. Make Siri better, but don't turn Siri into ChatGPT. You know, there's a fine line there because you want Siri to be better. It's like all the things that Siri's supposed to do now, imagine if it did them reliably and with lots of flexibility and sophistication. And maybe you could do one or two new things. But that is very different than, hey, guess what? Now you can just ask Siri anything and it will do something. That's not what we want, right? Because that is just throwing spaghetti against the wall, because you can get yourself into trouble real fast with just, especially since Siri has essentially control over your phone. And when it gets it wrong, there are consequences, bad consequences. So that is something, I mean, there's no rumor that, like, you know, that Siri is suddenly going to become ChatGPT, right? Apple needs to, it's kind of like what you were just saying, things that the phone already does, just make it do them better. But that is different than, Siri is now an all-knowing wizard that you can ask anything and cross your fingers.
Yeah, like I don't need Siri to become a chatbot. I don't need Siri to generate images that don't exist already for me. Many of the things that we think of as modern AI apps, I don't need Siri to do those things. What we need Siri to do is what the promise of Siri has always been promising, and it has just never reliably delivered on that promise. That's what we want to do. And I think, you know, looking at modern AI techniques and models and things, I think this gives them the ability to tackle what really is a pretty old set of problems in a new way that should theoretically be substantially better. So that's what I'm mostly looking for, is like, and everything else that we've talked about, like, you know, being able to control apps without configuration and stuff like that, that's all going to be great down the road whenever that comes together. I don't even need that right now. I just want Siri to work. That'd be great. And maybe, you know, give me a good captioning model on the phone that I can use. And otherwise, like, I think that could be enough for us. It's not going to be enough for the press. It's not going to be enough for the analysts. It's not going to be enough for Wall Street. But I think that would be enough for Apple's actual customers.
I have an addendum to an earlier statement. I meant to correct myself immediately, and then the time passed and I couldn't. But talk about when they're dropping Intel support. I forgot about all the AI stuff. The whole requirement to have an NPU, like that's why Rewind doesn't work on my computer. That may push the schedule forward. I mean, that wasn't really a glimmer in anyone's eye when back when we were talking about this years ago. But now the whole, like, you know, the Copilot Plus PC is requiring a 40 tops NPU, blah, blah, blah. You know, my CPU doesn't have an NPU in there, right? And aww. So every single one of these quote-unquote AI, if they bothered to add quote-unquote AI features, yeah, they could just make them not work on Intel, but they could all just not make macOS. Also does not make macOS work on Intel. So I feel like that nudges the possibility that this is the year my Mac isn't supported, nudges it a little bit. I don't think it makes it a slam dunk. I think it's a sure thing. I still think I'll probably be supported and just won't have features visible, but the LLM stuff is a problem for me.
Can you reprogram the Afterburner card to be an NPU?
It would still be so bad, right? Like, they're not spending any time optimizing any of this stuff. It's like, well, it runs in the neural engine, and also someone did an implementation for like the SIMD instructions on the Xeon. Nope, not happening.
Yeah, it's not. Sorry, you're out of luck on that one.
Yeah, so it's really just, I mean, like what Mac has going for it is like, Apple probably doesn't care that much. Oh, sorry, Intel Mac users, you don't get these new features, right? Just be glad macOS we still ship it for your CPU. And that, I feel like that has a likelihood because Apple's like, yeah, it's just Mac, it'll be fine, right? But if they really, it was the old Apple where it's like everyone on the same page, they'd be like, no, we're cutting them off this year because we got so many of the AI features and they all require the neural processor and Intel doesn't have that, so tough luck. We'll see. Like, the worst case scenario for me, it's like, I was going to ask you to what you're most looking forward to WWDC, but the thing I'm fearing the most is that I won't be able to run this version of macOS, or the feature that I want in macOS doesn't run on my thing. So for example, the photos features that use quote unquote AI to do cool photo stuff. Granted, there's ways I can use other AI tools to edit my photos. I don't need this to be built in, but if I can't even access those features, like if the person removal thing is built into the Photos app, I'm like, this is great, saves me a lot of time, it's right built in, I don't have to edit in an external editor, I don't have to go to a web page. Oh, but not on Intel. That's a big fear for me, because even though I would still, it's like, look, macOS still supports your system, no problem. I'd be like, oh, but I really want to use the new AI-powered photo editing features on my Mac, and now I'm sitting at my wife's computer to do photo editing, and she's complaining that I'm hogging her computer, and that hastens the timeline for me getting a new Mac, but yeah, which Apple hasn't shipped yet, like an M4 based Mac Studio or something. But anyway, that's, I want to throw that. Anyway, so what things are you most looking forward to? Marco, you already said Siri, but is there anything else, like, speaking of developer stuff, like, you know, developer tools, Xcode, Swift, like what big thing are you looking forward to at WWDC, assuming there's no hardware?
So, I mean, for me, like, you know, I really want to see kind of what I was talking about last episode. I want there to be good models that developers can use on the phone for free with no limits. Like, that's what I really want. Like, give us built-in AI SDKs that we can just use the same way we can use almost every other API on the phone. Like, that would be game-changing in so many ways. And so that's the big thing I want in terms of capability. Now, in smaller ways, like, you know, there's other like developer tool type stuff. Xcode has had a lot of bugs for me this past couple of years. A lot of, like, issues that don't clear that I've actually cleared. A lot of having to do clean builds just to clear weird compiler bugs. My rewrite of Overcast, I use a couple of packages that I do locally. And every time I change anything in the package, I have to go, like, resolve package caches because otherwise it just won't pick up the change. Like, there's all sorts of weird, like, just straight up bugs in Xcode, or at least things that's like behaviors that sure seem like bugs, that I think Xcode really could use some help in that area. I don't think they're going to be working on that. I suspect that
I think they are working on that. It's just a question of whether they'll fix more bugs than they introduce.
Yeah, like, because I'm sure that whatever they're doing, like with AI stuff, I'm sure there's obviously been massive demand for integration into Xcode of some kind of AI-based tooling, whether it's like an AI-based autocomplete, like the old version of what Microsoft called Copilot, or, you know, other stuff. Like, there's obviously a lot of demand for that in recent years.
And there's rumors for it. We didn't have mentioned in the past, but yeah, like, basically, like, oh, Xcode will help you write your code for you using AI. I'm assuming that's going to be there.
Like, can Xcode write around its own bugs using AI, maybe? Like, can it automatically, like, clear the issues for me so I don't have to do it?
When Xcode makes Swift UI view, the preview also won't work.
Right, exactly. Like, there's a lot in Xcode, a lot of the basics that I think could use some attention. But otherwise, like, in terms of the actual, like, you know, the APIs and the language, this is going to be a big year for Swift concurrency safety. this is going to, you know, this is the year of like Sendable really getting its moment, because I presume they're going to introduce Swift 6, and that brings with it a whole bunch of strict concurrency checks and theoretically some language enhancements that make complying with strict concurrency easier. Like right now, like when I as I've been writing the Overcast rewrite, and as I wrote Blackbird, I have tried to make them comply with the strict concurrency checks as they've existed in the pre-6 Swift languages. So like you've been able to opt in to these warnings that will tell you like, hey, this thing that you're doing over here with this like mutable state in this object, this will be an error in Swift 6. So there are I've been trying to comply with the requirements, you know, before it's even out, and it's pretty hard. And there are certain things where like this object here clearly is not being mutable state, and it's like losing its state right here before this is even returning from its init or whatever. Like there's all sorts of things like that, and there have been various proposals in Swift Evolution to like make some of that stuff automatic and like detect it, so you don't have to like jump through hoops to go around it. I haven't followed in detail of like whether those things are actually in Swift 6 or you know whether they will be. So I don't know.
A bunch of them are.
Yeah, I'm sure a bunch of them. And so what I want to know is like right now, all the stuff that will be an error in Swift 6 concurrency checking mode, a lot of that's pretty hard to work around. And so what I want to see is have they made it easier to work with for the actual release of Swift 6? Because that's what most of these proposals were aiming to do. So let's see. That's what I want to know is like as we go into this new era of Swift concurrency and Swift, you know, strictness, how easy is it to do the right thing? I've seen a lot of languages over time that make it hard to do the right thing. So far, Swift has been pretty good about it. So let's see. And then beyond that, as you know, I've been writing this whole rewrite using Swift UI and using you know Swift async modern concurrency wherever possible. And there are still a lot of system APIs that do not play well with Swift concurrency. I'm still having to write callbacks here and there. I'm still having to you know like shell out to like task to do something in a function. Like there are still areas in the system frameworks that have not been updated yet for Swift concurrency. I would love to just see more of that, please. Give me as much more as you can. Whatever you've gotten done this year, every year it gets better. So I just want to see like have everyone work on the frameworks throughout the year as they have time, and here and there I get updates that make things easier for me as a Swift async programmer. So that kind of stuff is mostly what I'm looking forward to. Most of like the boring tooling and API stuff, but that's what actually improves our lives as developers day to day in the following year. It's not like this one new hotness that we must use that's like some cool new API or something. Like no, usually it's just like a bunch of small life improvements that they made to the rest of the system and the rest of the tooling and the rest of the APIs. That's what I'm looking forward to mostly. But also, yeah, give me some of that cool transcription model, please. Thank you.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Swift stuff because that sitting here today, that's what I think I'm most excited for, is what is the new hotness within Swift? And Swift can get on my nerves from time to time, but by and large, 10 years on, because the announcement was, you know, 10 years and a few days ago, 10 years on, it is a really, really great language. It is not without problems. It's not without faults, but it is a really great language. And I do think it is mostly moving in a positive direction. And I feel like now that there's big and exciting things happening like Swift concurrency, I feel like a lot of the, what is the term or phrase, like bike shedding, is that what I'm looking for? That was going on in the like Swift 2.3.4 era, where we were worrying about really, really useless and dumb arguments that were happening all the time. And I don't know, John, you're more plugged in.
I don't think they were useless and dumb, but yes, there was some sort of, you do have to hash that stuff out, and it is important to get it right. So it might have seemed like a lot of kind of like, well, who cares what that keyword is called? It's not that important. Just do stuff that actually is kind of important because you get stuck with that stuff. So I don't have many complaints about the process, but...
But either way, like, you know, spending a whole bunch of time bickering about whether pre and post increment, you know, the plus plus operator should or should not be in the language, like, whatever, y'all, just move on. But anyways, all that to say, I feel like from what I've seen,
you guys really messed up substrings.
Oh, substrings.
Well, you know, there's some lousy things, but the thing is, if they come up with better ones, you can just abandon the lousy ones and never use them. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they've not painted themselves into a corner, which is really what you want to avoid with language design.
Yeah, everything they've done with like substrings and various like array index stuff. Oh my god! Like I still every time I have to manipulate an index or a string or something, I have to like look up code examples. Like I cannot figure out how the heck do I do this. I just want
substrings
give me this.
Are not strings.
Yep, it drives me nuts. But
and indexes are not integers.
I mean, it makes sense if you know why they're doing it for implementation efficiency. But it's like I don't want to have to see that. But just pretend it's not like that.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we're getting off on a tangent. So what? A lot of that bike shedding and yak shaving and whatever the turn of phrase you want to use is, I feel like that used to bubble up into my world insofar as like I don't pay attention to Swift evolution, even though maybe I should. But a lot of that navel gazing was bubbling out into my world, and I haven't seen much of that recently in at least a couple of years, which I think is a good thing because that means whatever is happening, instead of people going look at this ridiculous argument, you know, instead legitimate arguments are happening, good ones. And so I'm excited to see what Swift 6 brings. I am petrified. I cannot begin to tell you how scared I am of turning on the warnings for Swift, you know, for strict concurrency checks, because I'm sure it's going to be a mess. I'm not knowingly doing anything wrong, but I bet you I'm doing a lot wrong.
You got to try and it. You got to see.
It's not necessarily wrong. It's just that, I mean, I've made several runs of this, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more after WWC and following episodes. But like, in the absence of Swift concurrency, before it existed, we all did our own things using the technologies that Apple did offer at the time. Grand Central Dispatch, you know, callbacks, async await. Like, that's all kind of like creepy. It's not quite, you know, precursors to the big strict concurrency checks, right? So if you have an application that's already written, it's like, okay, but I already did a thing to deal with concurrency. Maybe it's not as good, but then Swift, you turn on the strict concurrency checks and it's like everything you're doing is a violation of strict concurrency. It's like, yeah, but this is what I had to do before you existed to do things concurrently. And so it's like, yeah, that approach, you should use a different approach to do that. Our approach is safer, but you end up having to like rethink stuff. It's not like I'll just add an annotation here and it'll fix it. It's like, I mean, this sounds dumb, but like the Swift concurrency strict checking thing wants you to use Swift concurrency features, right? It doesn't want you to use
it's
Grand Central Dispatch and queues, right? You can like satisfy it but it's like, if you just use these our features, like use strict concurrency, use what we want you to use actors, right? That's why they exist. And it's like, but I already did it a different way. And it's like, well, you're gonna have real problems trying to make me the compiler satisfied about that. So I'm sure there will be much discussion about that. I mean, the good thing about Swift, the Swift evolution process, it happens in public. Swift is open source. It's like, there should be no, for the most part, there should be no secrets revealed to Apple about the Swift language, right? About what they're doing with it, that'll be revealed. Like, because, you know, if you looked at like all the Swift language things, and it was like, and then Swift UI appeared. Swift UI wasn't developed in public, but Swift was, right? So, you know, we'll see what kind of surprises Apple has for us. But the Swift features they're adding, they know the pain people have trying to, you know, comply with Swift concurrency, and they're trying to make it easier. But fundamentally, I think the problem they have is that they want people to use actors and Swift concurrency as a way to manage concurrent processes, and that supersedes and replaces a bunch of things that people had used in the past. And figuring out how to do that without like changing your approach to concurrency, like Casey, I know you love to use the publisher thing with the source and syncs
combine.
And the events, what is that
which
called?
It's combined. I don't use that much of it in call sheet. I do use some, but it compared to just a couple of years ago, I use very, very little, and I only use it in a handful of places where it makes the most sense. Generally speaking, the concurrency and stuff that I'm doing is async await, which is good insofar as it's new, but it's bad insofar as I'm probably doing a rudimentary version.
Your stuff is not sendable, I'm sure.
For the most part.
I mean, sendable.
I can tell you that I use a lot of combine and async await in the rewrite. There's places for both of it, and I think they actually play somewhat nicely with each other if you don't do too, you know, ridiculous things with them, but those things do solve different problems.
They do.
Is not like, oh, I'm going to take all my data and I'm going to make everything sendable, because that's not how to fix this problem. You can't. Like, you have to have mutable state somewhere. It should be protected by actors, but like very often you're sending OS objects back and forth, and those aren't sendable, and you don't have a way to change that because you don't define that class, nor can you make it sendable or lie about it being sendable, and it's just Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure we're going off on a big tangent here because we're developers and we've all struggled with this. But like, I think the way Apple presents this story is interesting, down to like the idea of, you know, the warning Marco mentioned. This will be an error in Swift 6. Does that mean you can't use Swift 6 unless you have strict concurrency compliance? Or is there a mode in the Swift 6 compiler that lets you run Swift 5 code? And do you lose out on any features in Swift 6 if you decide to? Like, that's a story that Apple will tell, like, and has been telling in the open, but we'll see how marketing presents that. Like, Swift concurrency, it's great, but if you're not ready for it, don't worry. You can still use Swift 6. You just won't turn on the strict concurrency thing, kind of like it is in Swift 5 now.
Yeah, and I think that's the case. I could swear, and I'm probably getting the details wrong here, especially because my memory is, John makes fun of me justifiably, is very bad, but I could swear that Ben Cohen or someone on the Swift team has publicly stated, hey, Swift 6, it's going to be opt-in for the concurrency checks, and you still will be able to do the rest. This is what you just said, John. You'll still be able to do the rest of the Swift 6 hotness without buying or going all in on these strict concurrency checks.
Yeah, because you can just download the Swift 6 compiler right now and try it, like, and you can see how these features work or whatever. But like, it's, you know, doing it at open source and having the developers talk about it is kind of separate than from how Apple will present it, how Apple marketing will present this when it shows the new version of Xcode. You know what I mean? Like, how it manifests in Xcode, what the defaults are for a new project in Xcode. These are things that aren't actually strictly related to the Swift open source project, but have huge effects on how this change is perceived by the people who are not following Swift Evolution, which is most developers, right? You know, kind of like when they do new project, like, does it default to Swift UI? That is kind of like an important political thing. Does it default to strict concurrency? Does it default to adding tests, Marco? the defaults matter in Xcode and policy changes like that. So that is, you know, for developers, I mean, it is a developer conference. It's more esoteric, and you're not going to see big news stories about it. But the Swift 6 story is going to be interesting. And, you know, like you said, to most people, it's entirely new to them. It's public information. They could have been looking at it all since the last year. But most people, that's not their hobby, to keep up with language evolution. They just wait until a bit of BBC and see what Apple has to offer them, even though you could go download it right now and try it.
Exactly. And so for me, that's what I think I'm most interested in right now. Of course, I think I'm interested, you know, in the iOS changes and, you know, oh yeah, iPadOS is still a, you know, an operating system in our lineup. I'm very curious to see what the, you know, we'll get a second data point for VisionOS so we can start to draw a line between the two data points. But more than anything else, I'm very curious what my development life will look like for the next year plus. And I think some of that will probably be me ripping all my hair out trying to get this concurrency stuff working properly. But I think some of it should be fun and exciting. And, you know, as much as I will in one breath whine about Swift UI and tell you that it neuters me here and there, and, you know, there's nothing you can do to put a search bar anywhere but in a navigation bar, you know, and things of that nature, that it makes it very, very stodgy and difficult and unwavering. But I'll also tell you that it's just such a joy to work with, and so, so much nicer and so much faster than UIKit. And so I'd love to see what new Swift UI stuff is happening. It certainly seems like Apple internally is spending more and more time and putting more and more energy into consuming Swift UI, which makes me think they're doing the same for the, you know, within Swift UI itself. The best way for Apple to make a good API for developers is for them to dog food it. And they seem to be doing that more and more. So I'm excited for that. I don't know. I'm really excited, leaving aside the fact that, you know, I'm going to see you two, and that really leaving aside that I'm going to be there, that I'm going to be on at Apple Park. All of that is, of course, incredibly exciting. We covered that last week, but I'm just really excited to see what's coming because there's so little that has leaked out. Like we said, that what's leaked out is more of a, oh, there's AI dust to coming. You know, there's a dust storm a brewing, and that's about it. So
I still think the leaks have covered a lot. I don't expect to see tons of stuff that wasn't leaked. It's just that the stuff that's leaked is, I don't know, obvious or like not shocking. You know what I mean?
It's also a bit vague, like particularly around the AI stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it is vague, but like, you know, we won't get the details, but I don't think, well, we'll see. Will there be something that was like totally not rumored that is shocking? Yeah. I think it'll just be in the details how things work. And by the way, speaking of testing, I forget. I think there's a bunch of open source projects that do this, and I kind of hope Apple like adopts one of them or takes one under its wing or makes it official. But the XC test framework, which Casey may be familiar with, It's not great. It's kind of stodgy and old. And it's passable. if you've used a modern testing framework in like a language like Node or whatever, you kind of, or even, I mean, obviously all my testing experience comes from Perl, the great, great, great grandfather of good testing and programming languages. Just the fundamental stuff that you expect from a test framework is either doesn't exist or is very awkward in XC test because it's old. And so what does the Swift UI for testing look like? And there are a bunch of open source projects that try to do this, like make a sort of Swifty type API that looks kind of like the, you know, the popular testing packages for Node, or, you know, like just a nicer testing framework. I would love Apple to bless one of those and adopt it, or to come out with its own. I mean, this kind of falls into the category of what Marco was saying. Is like, hey, we've got a bunch of old APIs. Some of them aren't really Swifty, right? They don't match the language well. They don't take advantage of the features. They look kind of old. They're kind of awkward to use. We know better ways to do things now. Test framework is one of those things. I think that would be a big quality of life improvement for people. Of course, they have to keep supporting the old one basically forever because people use it and make huge test suites, but Swifty testing. There's been no rumors about that. I've just been looking at a lot of the open source ones. I'm like, these are all good ideas. Pick one, Apple, and do it.
I miss Fluent Assertions is one that I used in my .NET days. And so, you know, I'm looking at the about page trying to remind myself how it works. And basically, you know, say you have a string that's an account number is the example they use. And the code you write is account number should be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And so it's written almost like plain English, and it's not too dissimilar from what you see.
Like every word.
Yeah. Yeah. Account number dot should paren paren dot
yeah,
be.
That's a very popular trend. And
I know it's awful. It's code that looks great on slides and examples, and it's totally unwritable.
Yeah. Well, so it's not terrible, and that is a common thing, but really what you're looking for is the convenience of being able to essentially, you know, to just give one example, and I know XC test has ways of doing this, but it's awkward and weird. You have a bunch of nested data structures and objects, and you want to diff them, right? I don't want to have to do that manually. I just want it to be able to use reflection to traverse them and to give me like a really cool looking diff of where they differ. You know what I mean? Right. Mm-hmm. As opposed to comparing properties manually one at a time at each level and having messages to, so you know which part differed or whatever. Every modern testing framework has a way to say, is this thing like that thing? And they're both kind of deeply nested structures. And the good ones say, oh, and by the way, I don't care about these differences and ignore these properties, and I don't care about white space. And like, it's like, oh, that's just convenience method. You could do that all yourself. Yeah, you can. It's just annoying as hell. Right. So it's not so much the whole, oh, it looks like English, this should be that, and has this, and does this, and whatever. I just want, like, especially in a, you know, a language like Swift that's so, you know, really on board with static checking, and so you really just can't, just chuck these two things over the fence. So they look like they're the same. It's like Swift's like, whoa, these are totally different classes. I can't compare these two things. What are you talking about? I don't have those kind of reflection. It's like you really need convenient support from the framework to satisfy the Swift compiler to allow you to just say, is this thing like that? Expect this thing to be like that. That's going to be like this. You know, that stuff is tedious in testing. It makes people not want to write tests.
Like Marco.
Well, that's not why. Sick but burn. If he did write tests, he would say, boy, it sure is tedious comparing these deeply nested object trees to each other. And then, you know, and if you get lazy, when the test fails, you're like, why did it fail? What was the problem? And you basically got to step through it in the debugger because there's no, like, you know, automatic diffing of object trees to tell you exactly where it failed.
Yeah. Anything else you're looking forward to, John?
You know, I mentioned the photos feature because that's what I'm thinking about a lot. Like, again, when I edit photos, I have many tools. I've purchased many other external editors. I have Photoshop. I have Photomator, Pixelmator. I have Raw Power. I have access to web tools or whatever. But there's something to be said for having stuff built in. And Photos does have stuff built in, but it's so outdated now. Like the quote-unquote healing brush in the Apple Photos app is just barbaric compared to what the good apps can do. But I don't always want to edit an external editor. I certainly don't want to export and edit it on the web and bring it back or whatever. So to the extent that Apple can catch up and add those features to Photos itself, and I can actually run them on my Intel Mac, that will be a big quality of life change for me. I will really appreciate that, not this year, but next year when, you know, for my Long Island beach vacation pictures. I want it to be in the Photos app. I want the Photos app to get better. This is not the year, it seems like. If there's something about Apple's platforms that you want it to get better that doesn't have to do with AI, this is not the year. All the bugs I report in the Finder, all those things that are annoying you, the apps that you feel like are neglected and haven't had any attention paid to them, this is not the year they're going to fix that. You know, usually it's never the year that they're going to fix that, but definitely not this year. What they're going to do, those teams spent time adding AI features or whatever, and so I will appreciate those when I have them, but, like, you know, we're all still hoping for that year when the bug that's been in your favorite operating system for 10 years finally gets fixed, but it just does not seem like this is the year for that. And it wasn't last year, and it wasn't the year before that, and it wasn't the year before that, and it wasn't the year before that, and it's a big systemic problem that we've discussed in the show, but definitely not this year because everyone's been off doing AI stuff. So that's kind of a shame. But yeah, if I had a wish list, it would be like, oh, they fixed all my longstanding bugs. That's not going to happen. I'm looking forward to the photos editing features. I am kind of looking forward to the better Siri. Like, I rarely use Siri, but the things I use it for, I find useful. The, you know, remind me to do whatever, use that all the time, almost daily, right? Because I know how to do it. I know the syntax it wants. I know how it works for the most part. It could be better, but it just shows the utility. If you can give me something that I can, that works enough for me to use it, it has a big effect on my life. So if they just take something that Siri has supposedly been able to do for 10 years and they make it good enough for me to want to use it, that will could potentially have a big impact. So I'm kind of looking forward to that as well. And I was looking forward to hardware, but that doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So yeah. And the Swift 6 stuff, like I said, I'm mostly looking forward to how Apple presents the stuff that I've already been reading about in Swift Evolution for an entire year. Like, what is the pitch? What are the ergonomics of it? How does it manifest in Xcode? How do they present it to the world? Because there is a potential for pushback, let's say, right? You know, for everyone who has tried it, it's an obscure flag that you have to know about, like, oh, strict concurrency, all caps, blah, 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 equals whatever, and you're built. Like, it's not obvious how to do it in existing Xcode, but the people who try it, they're like, oh, 50,000 warnings. I'm like, wow, I reduced that to 100 after just changing two lines of code. And then they spend a week trying to get that 100 down to 10. And then they spend a month trying to get that 10 down to 0, right? Depending on how much of their app they're willing to rewrite. That's a tough story to pitch to people. And I'm, you know, setting aside the technology and the actual features, how do you present that to a room full of developers and make them excited about it and not dreading it? Like, you know what I mean? And that is going to be a challenge this year, I think.
All right, let's do at least a little bit of Ask ATP. It's been a little while since we've done it. And let's start with James, who writes, any chance that the now expected late 2024 M4 MacBook Pro gets upgraded to Thunderbolt 5? And my question to James is, why do we care? Not to say that we shouldn't. I'm not saying that the question is unreasonable, but I genuinely don't even know what Thunderbolt 5 brings. So
faster,
John,
speed. That's what we talked about on the show in the past. Unlike Thunderbolt 3 to 4, which didn't increase the speed at all, Thunderbolt 5 does. You know, is there a chance? Yes, there is a chance. I think there is. I don't know enough about the M4 and the iPad, if anyone has examined it and see if there's any vestiges of Thunderbolt 5 or whatever. But, you know, there's always a chance. It's not a good chance. You know, Apple has not really been known for being on the late. We talked about this when we were talking about the Copilot Plus PCs and how they just all have the latest versions of every standard, latest version of Bluetooth, latest version of Wi-Fi, like latest version of Thunderbolt, right? Apple doesn't really do that. When they do, it's notable. Apple's current line of stuff have won back from the latest version of most of this stuff, because that's just the way Apple tends to roll. So I don't think it's highly likely, but absolutely it is possible. Keep hope alive for those M4 MacBook Pros with Thunderbolt 5.
David Martin writes, do you think Apple will finally ship 16 gigs of RAM in the MacBook Air when the M4 gets put into it? I don't, but
nope.
I hope.
You can hope. Now's the time you can have this hope. I don't think so. They should. They 100% should, but I don't think so. I mean, do the MacBook Pros start at 16? I forget.
I think the Pros do.
Even the low-end one that's, like, barely a Pro?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me either way. I mean,
anyway,
they're going to keep shipping. For the MacBook Air, that is a computer that is extremely important for it to hit a price point for its sales, and Apple will not sacrifice its margins. So they're going to get their, you know, whatever 38%, whatever their margin is, like, they're going to get their margin somewhere. And so, if they make more money on average by skimping on the RAM on that base model, they're going to keep doing that. They're going to keep doing it as long as they possibly can.
See, on the MacBook Air, though, I think that is, of all the computers Apple sells, I feel like the MacBook Air is probably the least likely to have its specs bumped, because people just want the cheapest laptop they can get. And so, like, I mean, on the MacBook Pros, like, how, like, what percentage of MacBook Pros are purchased with the base RAM versus the percentage of MacBook Airs? The MacBook Airs has got to be so much bigger than the MacBook Pros, right?
I don't know, because in both cases, huge amounts of them are purchased by businesses and schools and stuff like that. So, like, and I think usually when you're talking about those big bulk buys, it's very, very frequently it is either the base model or, like, the next stocked up config that is normally stocked, like, not a custom build. But there's tons of base model sales sold in any case. So I bet it is a pretty high ratio for both the Air and the Pro, although I think you're right, it probably is higher for the Air.
Yeah. Well, anyway, like, they can't stay at 8 forever, just like they couldn't stay at 4 forever. Do they have to double? Do they have to go from 8 to 16? I mean, the iPads apparently come with 12, but they're only using 8 of it. Like, you can go up. You don't have to double it every time. Like, it would be nice. They would be catching up. I think it would be a good idea. But, like, 16 seems too generous for their lowest-end laptop.
It's not.
The M4 version of their lowest-end laptop.
It's 2024.
But they absolutely should, because the 16 versus the 8 costs them, like, $5 extra. And the only way it would hurt the margins, is why Marco was mentioning it, is it will stop people from buying the more expensive model where they charge you $1 billion for that RAM, right? That's how it hurts margins. Not because, like, oh, that's not hurting margins. That extra RAM costs them nothing. That's true, but it stops you from buying the one where they overcharge for the RAM upgrade. And that is the problem that Apple's trying to avoid. But yeah, they need to bump their RAM. If they're going to do this thing where they just will only ever double it and will wait until it is incredibly embarrassing before they do the doubling, that's not a good dynamic, and I hope they should fix it. But
I think they will upgrade the MacBook Air RAM once the whatever type of RAM chip the MacBook Air uses is no longer available in 8 gig chips. That's when they will finally update it.
I mean, like, not it was in the iPad. Then. Maybe they, you know, maybe they those ones aren't available. I don't think they're ever not going to be available. Like, but it's just. When is someone had a similar question, I think I cut it out of this, is like, which do you think will happen first? The MacBook Air gets 16 gigs of RAM or some other highly unlikely thing? And it was like, you know, a rock and a hard place, two things that Apple just does not want to do. But, you know, they can't hold the line on RAM forever. They will have to bump it eventually. It's just maybe not this year.
Winnie Lewis writes, could Apple's reluctance to put cellular on the Mac be due to their failure to produce an in-house modem? Considering Apple's reluctant dependence on Qualcomm and the exorbitant rates Qualcomm charges, I can understand why Apple's holding off on adding cellular to high-priced devices like the Mac. This argument is undercut somewhat with the iPad Pro costing the same as a MacBook Air, but MacBook Pros can still greatly increase in price over an iPad Pro. And if customers have waited this long, what's the harm in making them wait longer?
What's the
harm? Yeah, that's fair. I feel like we've talked about this a couple of times in the past.
Yeah. Well,
but
we need to debunk this again, because we've mentioned this years ago, and then we corrected ourselves, and some people are still going with the outdated information. The idea that Qualcomm charges you a percentage of the purchase price of the product, and because Macs can be so much more expensive, that Apple would be charged a ton more. That's not how it works based on our most recent looking into this. Like, there is a cap, and Apple's already at the cap. Like, Qualcomm, whatever, they'll charge you a percentage up to whatever the amount is. And basically every Mac is already at that maximum cap. So Apple is not avoiding cellular in Macs because it would be too expensive relative to putting cellular in iPads and other devices. They could be doing it for whatever their reasons are. That's not it. Like, it's not like, oh, they can't do it because you can buy a $5,000 Mac and then a Qualcomm will get $500 of that. That's not how it works. At least, you know, it used to be, and then we were corrected, and then we aired the correction, and I think it is still the case that there is a monetary cap for this.
Yeah, I just, and like, I every possible argument people put up for why cellular maybe is being held back from the laptops for some kind of weird business reason. But yet it's like, it's in
the iPad Pro kills them. Now.
It's in every iPad. Like, it's even, okay.
It's the same
in
processor.
The $350 base model. Like, you have to pay a little more, you know, for the cellular, but like it's been available on every iPad ever since 2010. So every iPad model has had cellular as an option that has cost between usually $130 and $200 extra. And it is great. It just works. Like, and the only thing I can think of is, like, in some various forms of their deals with carriers or their pricing with Qualcomm, I'm sure there are differences in like how the devices are categorized. Like, I'm sure they have different agreements and different rates for if something's considered a phone or a wearable or a tablet or a PC. Like, I'm sure those are, like, different categories for some kind of licensing deals or whatever. But again, like, cellular laptops have existed in the PC world for a very long time now. So obviously this is not something that's that difficult to navigate with the carriers and the royalty holders like Qualcomm and things like that. Like, this isn't a difficult problem, and this isn't a problem that no one has solved. This is a choice that they've made, that they just don't care. And I'm sure if an Apple person was here, I'm sure we would get a wonderful PR answer of, like, you know, how important it is to serve our customers and they, you know, what we show, blah, blah, blah. But, like, look, actions speak louder than words. Apple does not care about cellular on the Mac. They have not prioritized it. They seem to have no path to get there from where, like, they seem to be in no rush to do it. And we are so far past the point where, like, it can't be just like, oh, they're working on it, but it's not done yet. No, we're so far past that point.
Yeah, I mean, iPad Pro being so expensive, you can make an iPad Pro more expensive than a Mac pretty easily by configuring it. It's the same, you know, they're using the same SoCs, all Apple Silicon. Like, every excuse has fallen away. Winnie's question here is, though, is actually vaguely plausible, is that Apple has been planning to bring cellular to the Mac just as soon as they're done with their in-house modems.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, no.
Unfortunately, they pinned that feature to the timeline of a product that is terminally behind, right? Apple's been trying to, they bought that modem business from Intel, and they've been trying to make cell modems, and they wanted to do this for their phones, obviously. But, like, maybe they said, we're not even thinking about cellular in the Mac until we get our modem stuff. And the modem stuff should be ready by 2022, right, guys?
But even that theory, why? It's literally been in every single iPad.
That's totally an Apple thing to do, though. It's totally an Apple thing to do.
But why? How different is the hardware in a MacBook Air versus the hardware in an iPad?
I know. Well, this is definitely a business thing. If you work in a big company, someone will say, we're going to do this. It's been a long-standing thing that people want, and we're going to tie it to this other thing. And then the other thing gets delayed, and then the people will say, can we just untie these two things now and just do, you know, like you said, just do what we do in the iPads? Can we just stick a Qualcomm thing? And there's just a tremendous institutional sort of resistance to untying two things that have been tied to each other, especially when it comes to a product line that is not the top priority. Like, if you tie something on the phone and it turns out, oh, you know, now one thing is delaying another, untying that is easier because the phone is so important. But on the Mac, I'm sure it's like, no, we've already started down this path. We're working on the modems. Let's just wait until they're done. I think they're going to be done this year. And they're not done. And then the next year you have the same conversation and with the same result. That is plausible. It is a common dysfunction of businesses. But, you know, us out here as customers, like, we don't care what the reason is. We just want it. And, you know, I think Apple's answer would be like, well, you may want that, but you're in the minority, so tough luck.
But how many iPad owners choose it? How many Apple Watch owners choose it?
Well, we feel like iPad owners
prioritize it differently. The Apple Watch has a cellular
modem. When we survey Mac users, a very small percentage seem to want it, and our tethering solution is so amazing, and blah, 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 blah. That's what they would say. Not that there's any reason that they're not doing it, but that it's like, well, we have to prioritize it. Even though you super-duper want it, not everybody is like you. I think that's what they'd say.
And again, if tethering is the answer, why do iPads have it? Why does every iPad
ever have
it? And why
is tethering so bad?
Like, that's, you know, that too, yeah. But that's the thing, like, it's no argument against it holds any water once you say, well, then why is it available in every single iPad they've ever made? Like, that, mm-hmm. It just makes no sense when you consider that. Like, why, like, I just, oh, God, like, as much as, I'm kind of glad that, like, the iPad mania is passing now from the iPad Pro update, because, like, I'm so annoyed at the thought, like, how amazing would it be if the MacBook Air was released with an OLED screen and cellular. We would be flipping our
minds.
OLED
screen? Whoa, whoa, whoa. That is a pro product, Marco. People with iPad Airs cannot handle faster than 60 hertz refresh, because that is also a pro product. And they cannot handle OLED screens. Don't even talk about that for at least 5 more years.
Like, versus. Why is that? I'm just, I shouldn't get all mad. Why does the iPad Pro, in even an 11-inch form factor, have an M4,
a great
OLED screen, cellular, in a really small package that costs around a little over $1,000 if you put the keyboard on it and stuff, and the MacBook Air with most of those same guts at about the same price, is not only does it not have those features at those price, but those features are not attainable at any price on that product. Why?
It's so frustrating.
Yeah, well, I mean, but part of that is that the iPad you were describing is the most expensive iPad, and the laptop you were describing is the least expensive. And Apple wants to segment its product line. But yeah, I mean, you can't even get the
same people are looking at both of those products.
I know. You can't even get the OLEDs on the MacBook Pro, so it really hurts that argument for now. But we'll see how it goes.
The OLED's brand new. Like, I understand that's going to be a process of, like, you know, bringing it to everything slowly. Sure. Cellular is not.
Yeah.
Oh, my. It's so not new. Like, I was using a cellular modem to tether my laptop in 2006. Like, this is not new.
No, I hear you and I agree. But if we continue this any further, it will turn this entire show into a Marco and Casey whine about Cellular Max Power Hour. So I feel like at this point we should probably call it, even though I would like to agree with all your grumbling and whining, because I am right there with you.
You're just making so many people write in to say how little they care about cellular on their Macs, and it's a useless feature, and Apple should never add it.
Oh, please don't.
And if it's so useless, why is it on every iPad? Thank you so much to our sponsors this episode, Squarespace and Factor. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. Members get an exclusive after-show topic every week called Overtime. This is an extra bonus topic that we do every week now. Members exclusive. You can hear it for yourself by joining atp.fm/join. This week on Overtime, we are talking about an update on Apple's car integrations, things like, you know, the latest CarPlay and things like that. So that's going to be an update on Apple in cars in Overtime this episode for members. Join atp.fm/join. Thank you so much to everybody for listening, and we will talk to you live from California next week.
All right.
What do we have for the show? John had something, right?
Yeah. All right.
Oh, yeah.
What? How did we talk about? Oh, this was this David Griffin's feedback? Is that right? I'm trying to think of the right way to pitch this.
David Griffin's feedback? No, this is from when we did the member special.
Right, but then I thought he was yelling at us for not buying a Tesla for every reason, always.
No, that's not what this is about. It was at the end of the thing of the member special where we were talking about what car would we buy if we had to buy now. I added the bonus thing of like,
car
for a kid. This is that.
All right, I got you. Thank you. Because there was discussion in David's email about that, which got me confused. All right, well, here I am. Bye-bye, Future Marco.
Bye.
All right, so we're going to do a little post-show neutral today, and we're going to talk about our member special. This is the most recent member special as we are recording right now, which was talking about cars and car-related things. And so, John, I guess you would like to revise your statement with regard to buying cars for your kid?
I just have updates. Like, I threw at the end of our discussion, the discussion was like, if you had to buy a new car now, what would you buy? And we had all the sorts of conditions and caveats and whatever, and we got increasingly ridiculous. At the very end, I said, what about buying a car for a kid? Which, you know, neither one of your children are driving age, but mine are. So I'm like, maybe this will come up. Anyway, we talked about it, and it's a difficult problem and yada, yada. But the problem has continued to exist in my household. We have 4 licensed drivers and 2 cars. And that is a difficult situation. And it's made more difficult, honest, by me, because I don't want my children to drive my car. Right? So now we have 4 licensed drivers, and 2 of them can only drive one of the cars. So it's kind of like the whole, you know, bringing the goat and the chickens and the wolf across the river or whatever. Of like, okay, well, if this person wants the car on this day, then because I will let my wife use my car, right? So that means she'd have to take my car when she goes to work. So her car is here for the kids to use, and then it's just, it's a pain, right? And we're talking about on the show is, if you had to buy a car for your kid, what would you buy? Because I'm faced with that problem. We were considering trying to get a kid car. Not a car for a kid. They could buy their own car eventually. And maybe one of these cars eventually will be given to / sold to the kid when they graduate college and move out of the house. But we just wanted to have a car that the kids can drive, that, like, if they bang it up or hit a curb or get into a fender bender, we don't care about it. And they're not driving our cars, and we don't have to do this car shuffle thing. And I've been working on this problem since we recorded that member special. And as you can imagine, I make it so much more difficult for myself because of what I want out of this. So here's the difficulty.
Okay. Let me guess. The end of this discussion is, you have bought or will buy either an Accord, which is my guess, or a Civic, because I cannot fathom you owning any other car manufacturer's product.
Here's I'm looking for cars and getting frustrated. Here's the frustration. First one, let me find a crap box. Well, I'm trying to use the kind word for that, right? That's fine. A kid car, like it's like a $2,000 thing. Like it's junky. You don't care. You know what I mean? Like
the old Volvo box.
Yeah. And I was even looking at old Volvos. It was like, you know, trying to find a Volvo or whatever. And I was looking at like the safety ratings and stuff. And not that Volvos aren't safe. They are. But like the safety rating information available to us is not granular enough for me to distinguish how much better a Volvo is than like some other car of similar vintage. You know what I mean? Like, because everyone games the system. Like, they all want to get 5-star crash rating or whatever. And so 2 5-star cars, they're not the same. They both got 5 stars, but one of them is probably better than the other. But how much better and how can I tell? But anyway, I'm looking for crap boxes. And there's a lot of them available, but they're crappy.
Hence the name.
Right. I mean, they have like 200,000 miles on them. They're filled with rust because it's New England, right? Like any car that you can buy for a very small amount of money that has huge amount of miles, it's just going to be rusted out. It's going to have so many mechanical problems. I don't want to leave my kids stranded. I do want it to be safe, but any car that's like $2,000 is going to be old, and older cars are less safe. They have less safety equipment. They weren't they're safe in crash testing. You know what I mean? And it's like, do I want my kid to be in an unreliable car that's going to cost me like $1,000 in repairs once I bring it home and realize that the engine is dead or it needs a new water pump or all the brakes are shot or whatever.
Did you
and
get
so
yourself
I'm looking
a new
and
car?
You're like, you're hoping you're going to find
that. That's exactly
that.
What I was wondering. Are we pulling a Marco and buying ourselves a new car?
We're just talking about the crap boxes now, right? It's like you're always hoping to find like the car that was just driven like to church on Sunday every day and kept in an air conditioned garage and, you know, like it has a small number of miles on it, but that it just doesn't exist. And then so I'm looking for used cars like that. And then I go up, okay, well, what if I say it's not a crap box? What if I look for a decent used car? Then what happens with my philosophy is like I go right from crap box on Craigslist or whatever, right? I go from that. I immediately go to a website. Well, I don't want a crap box. I don't want to worry that this car is unreliable. I want a car that doesn't have a lot of miles, that's probably pretty reliable. And you get into the whole land of like certified, pre-owned with warranty from mm-hmm. dealer type things.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Those cars cost as much as a new car.
Yeah.
I was like, what the hell? And you're going to say, is there nothing in between? Yeah, there are things in between, but I don't want what's in between. I either want a crap box that costs me nothing or a very reliable car. And guess what? If you want a very reliable car with not a lot of miles, it's basically the price of a new car.
Now, wait, hold on. I don't really disagree with anything you've said, although I have not gone car shopping in like 6 years now. But
you're always going car shopping. Come on.
Well, yes and no. But anyways, I haven't done serious car shopping. I've done no more than kick some tires. But anyways, first of all, and I just leave this be because we'll get on a huge tangent, but you should be buying a lightly used electric car for your kids because it doesn't have a lot of
lightly
range.
Used electric car. Please point me to those.
Yeah, get
they're
a Leaf or something, or like even like old Model 3 at this point. Like, there's so many. Yeah. There's so many out there now.
So I'm not going to buy a Tesla. So we can just take that off the table.
Okay, fair.
Nissan Leafs, I did look at them, but they don't have like conditioned batteries. So all their batteries, and again in New England, are so hosed. It's not even funny. Like the used ones, you know what I mean? Because they don't even do like.
It's your own fault for living somewhere with shit weather. I mean, what do you expect?
And a Nissan Leaf it's not an unsafe car, but I'm not. Sure,
there
you know,
are options
and the thing is, even a lightly used electric car, they're expensive. You can't buy. There's no such thing as a crap box version of that. And then all of a sudden, you're getting into new car territory prices, right? It's like, you buy a lightly used Nissan Leaf for $22,000.
Okay, that's fair.
New car territory.
Okay, so the other thing I was going to say is there is an in between that I'm sure you will thumb your nose at for some reason or another, and maybe it's that you just don't have these where you are, but. You know, it's local hero CarMax, which I think I've mentioned many times.
I've spent a lot of time on their website.
It's headquartered here in Richmond. And they, to the best of my recollection, not only do they typically sell decent used cars, and it's always a crapshoot. I'm not saying they're guaranteed to be perfect, but they're usually pretty decent. But A, they do have like a 1-week return policy on freaking automobiles, which is pretty cool. But secondly, you can choose to buy into their like extended warranty. And so you can basically like create your own CPO situation. Granted, it does cost extra money. It's not free, but you can basically create your own CPO situation by giving them some money up front. And then they will do a bumper to bumper warranty on this used car, which might be the best of both worlds for you. Although I suspect that they're probably still more expensive than you would want to spend.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on CarMax, Auto Trader, Auto Tempest, Cars and Bids, even where I've had saved searches for months on Cars and Bids just out of my own curiosity. Cars and Bits is more of like an enthusiast site, and I have like save searches for like the last stick shift Accord or whatever.
No, of course. To go back a step, I'm embarrassed. I forgot about this because my parents have one. D-Temp from the chat brings up, why not a used Chevy Bolt? They weren't that expensive new. They can't be so expensive.
The used EV things, like there's a lot of things keeping me away from the used EVs. Like you can't get them cheap. They have old cruddy batteries. The NCAS thing is out there too, and it's like, do I want to buy an electric car with a connector I know is not going to be the connector I want it to have, and wire my house up for that kind of, like, I'm not.
Oh, it's so easy.
The adapters aren't that big, but it's like there's the main thing is there's no electric cars that I like. Like at this point that I can afford, right? There's no.
But it's not for you. It's for your kids and the Chevy Bolt.
But that's
Bolt
the thing. It's
the
not.
Answer.
It's not. It's a kid car, but it's not for the kid. It's like
what?
The title is going to be in our name. It's not going to be the child's car.
It doesn't matter who's driving.
I know they're the ones. I know they're the ones driving it. But like the thing is, if I'm going to spend like five digits, $10,000 to $20,000, whatever dollars on a thing, I want it to be a car that I like. That maybe that's just a me thing. I don't know. It's like, it's not for you. It's just, you know, it's a kid car. I can't buy a car I don't like.
On the plus side, now I understand why you give me so much shit about about me driving an automatic, even though I drive Aaron's car maybe 100 miles a year. But now I get it. Aaron's car is Aaron's car. Yes, it is our car, legally speaking, but I almost never drive that thing. It's her car. If she wanted something that I really disagreed with, I would have a conversation with her about
it. She's your wife, not your child.
Well, even still, like I don't understand why you're hanging your hat so much on it needs to be something John approved. Like, who freaking cares? As long as it's not an absolute disaster, it's not for you.
It has to be me approved. There's no electric cars that I like. They're very expensive. I'm worried about the battery life or the battery health. There's not a lot of good cheap ones.
Well, Bolt batteries have been replaced under warranty. Like most of them have. You really are doing yourself.
The Bolt is probably the best contender in that category because, like I said, the Leaf doesn't have the conditioned batteries. The Bolt did have that battery problem, and they've been replaced. It's, you know, they are still kind of expensive, but that is actually a good possibility. But you know, there's a lot of unknowns there with, you know, having it be our first electric car and having it be for the kids and everything like that. So anyway,
you're coming up with excuses, darling, but like, whatever you need to do.
It's not the shape of the market that's forcing these two polar things. It's my desires that are forcing them, that it either has to be a crap box or a reliable car, and the crap boxes are too crappy and the reliable ones are too expensive, and the EVs are too expensive, or I don't like them, or I think it's not the right time to be an EV, especially for kids, right? So that got me into that situation, and you know,
I feel like there are options that will solve this problem, which it is well within your right to say I don't care and they're not for me, but I do think there are options out there for you that would work. But carry on. What car did you buy yourself?
Yeah, well, so that's it's not me that's the problem here. It's
it's
my
not
wife.
You?
I assure you it's you.
It is 100% you,
with respect, to like getting the car. Once my wife got wind of the idea that I was looking for a third car for the kids to drive, you know what happened. She's the Marco in this situation. She's like, oh, you're looking at cars?
She wanted a new car?
No.
You know, my car is kind of old.
Mm-hmm.
She is right, isn't you? No. Hers is newer than yours.
Hers is the newest. It's 2017.
Okay.
It's not
right. Okay.
But she gets the 7-year itch. Literally, the 7-year itch.
Better here than other places, John.
I'm not looking for a car for you. You already have a car. I'm trying to get the kids out of your car so they won't wreck it and give them a car. And she's like,
why not just let them continue to wreck it and get her a new one?
But you're looking at cars. I like cars.
Oh gosh. Before you say anything, I'm going to wager, but I don't know how this is going to turn out. I really don't, but I'm going to wager that Tina has decided she would like something new and thus will want something that only has two pedals, not necessarily because she prefers that, but because there's no other choice at this point. And now you have a marital issue as to whether or not Tina will have a two pedal car. That's what I'm going to guess.
I'll go even further. I'm going to say Tina wants an EV.
Well, you don't know her driving taste, apparently. That's the thing I forgot to mention before is that, you know, all our cars are stick shift. My kids both learned on stick shift. They're not stick shift enthusiasts. My daughter, in particular, had real hatred for stick shift, and she's like, when are you going to get a good car? She just doesn't.
That hurts me deep down inside.
Well, they're kids, right? Whatever. That's their taste, right? Like, all my friends have good cars with just two pedals in them or whatever. She's come around a little bit on it since, like, getting more comfortable with it. But my son, he can drive stick fine, but he's also just not into it. They're not into it, at the very least. So the whole idea with the kid car is we would get an automatic. The kid car would be automatic, right? Because they both don't like it, and the whole point is that they would drive it and whatever, right? Because, I mean, they, if they're not enthusiasts, stick shifts will have no place in their future life, right? You know what I mean? It is what we had. They had to learn on it, whatever. But, you know, anyway.
See, but in my recollection of Tina was of her preferences was that she actually legitimately does prefer three pedal cars, but I feel like she has more, she is more willing to give on that issue than you and probably I are.
Well, when she started saying, you're looking at cars, I would like a car. I think she also eliminated EVs along with me because they're just very expensive, especially if she's looking for a car for herself. And she's not, I don't think there's any EVs that she really likes either. So there's nothing out there that she's like pining for or desires or whatever. And it, when it comes to non-EVs, she wants a stick.
Which, I mean, I love that. I love that, right? But good luck.
I mean, there's a reason. I'm not forcing her to buy stick cars. Every car we've owned has been stick because that's what she wants. Mm-hmm. She's driven automatic. She drives rental cars. We're watching our friend's car now, and they asked us to drive it once in a while, and she drives it. She wants a stick. And, you know, she knows they're being rare, and she knows eventually we won't have one, and we'll have an EV or whatever. But, you know, so she's out there saying, and she doesn't know what's available, what's out there, but I do.
Golf R and Golf GTI. Or maybe GTI already folded, but the Golf R is briefly still available.
We went from let's buy a kid car and have it be automatic to let's not do that and let's get a third stick car, which would make my children's head explode. It's like, what? You got another car and it's also stick? And it's like, I have news for you about the cars we've purchased in our life. And we can't drive it. Anyway, I know what's out there with stick. Obviously, Accord doesn't have stick anymore. So that is eliminated. My wife does know that. I've told her about it so she could begin her mourning period many years ago, right? But many other cars do have stick shifts in them. But since getting her 2017, she has a 2017 Accord with stick shift. She has some new requirements that have been added to the I want a new car. Can you guess what her new requirements are?
CarPlay.
That's one of them. Right, and by the way, how did she get that requirement? None of our cars have CarPlay. We've never owned a car with CarPlay. How does she get that? Because she knows it exists and she's used it.
Yeah, exactly.
She's seen the forbidden fruit. Yep. So she and not only does she want CarPlay, she wants
wireless
CarPlay.
Oh, good friggin' luck. You're either getting like a Kia, which there's nothing wrong with that, or a BMW. That's your choice.
I have personally never used CarPlay.
By the way, I can tell you, Tina, the latency really sucks.
Yeah, I was going to say, wireless CarPlay.
It is convenient,
like,
though. Like, Tiff's car has it. She, in her i3. It is convenient, but the latency never stops being annoying.
It's not great, but I don't personally get as offended by it as you do. But, I mean, you're not entirely wrong. All right, but don't worry, we're getting sidetracked.
I was trying to picture, I would say, like, wireless, like, I have to preface this by saying I've never used it, but in my I have suspicion that maybe you would actually prefer wired just because of the reliability and, latency or whatever. But whatever, right? There's that. And there's one other thing that she wanted.
Well, hold on. For the record, because I know Tina is or will listen to this, is listening or will listen. Wireless CarPlay, if you do the kind of driving that I do, which maybe she does not, so take this with the appropriate amount of caveats and salt and whatnot. I tend to be in the car 10, maybe 15 minutes at a time. It is very unusual I'm in the car for more than about 15 minutes. And so it's a lot of shorter trips. And because of that, and I realize how entitled I sound right now, but it's very burdensome to take my phone out of my pocket, or in her case, purse perhaps, and plug it in and then unplug it, put it back in the pocket/purse, whatever. I find if you're doing a lot of short trips like I am, I personally think that even with the higher latency, that juice is worth the squeeze. And furthermore, these little boxes like the one I have, they're not phenomenal, but they work just fine. It is more than sufficient if you're not, a complete snob about it, that it will get the job done and you can retrofit wireless into a wired only car. So I wouldn't go too bananas on insisting wireless, but I don't think on the surface there's anything necessarily wrong with it. I would cave on wireless CarPlay long before I would cave on many of the other things that I'm sure are requirements.
Yeah, and so I will say too, like what you said about like your driving pattern of like frequent short trips, wireless CarPlay is very good for that. Like it is very convenient for that, as long as you don't actually really like interact with the screen that much, because the interactions, like the latency will annoy you, but it is nicer than the alternative of just like Bluetooth controls. Like it's nicer than that at least, so in most cases. So yeah, that I get that.
So what is the other feature she wants?
Other than a stick shift, I don't think you guys do
these,
a lot
these
of
are
highway
new features. Like, so obviously it's a stick shift, right? But this is the thing, the request that she's never had for any previous car that she suddenly has. Car, wireless CarPlay is one, she's, because it didn't exist last time she bought a car.
And most of the cool new, like, you know, adaptive cruise features and stuff, most of those are not available on sticks.
And they existed before.
You say that,
they,
but my,
those,
my
those
car
things
has,
before too.
My car has radar cruise, and it won't come to a complete stop, but it will slow down. So that's actually exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say some sort of radar, you know, or I forget the like industry standard term for it, but basically
adaptive cruise control.
There you go. Thank you. Adaptive cruise control. That was going to be my guess.
Yeah, that's a great feature. Like that's something you want if you don't have it.
Yeah, well, she's never had it, and unlike CarPlay, apparently she hasn't experienced it enough to want to know. The thing that she demands, that is a hard requirement now, because she's had it once, heated seats.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
I know that sounds boring to you people who get fancy cars all the time, but again, we have never purchased a car for more than $25,000. We have the very first car we have ever owned with heated seats is her current car, which is 2017.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, 100%.
By the way, don't stop there. Get the heated wheel, too. Trust me.
I was going to say the same thing. So my car does not have a heated wheel. Aaron's car does. And every time I get in her car in the winter, it annoys the crap out of me, because even in our pretend winters, John, it is still delightful to have a heated steering wheel. So, again, I wouldn't make that a requirement in the same way I wouldn't require wireless CarPlay, but I would strongly, strongly encourage it.
So, the things I've outlined to you, stick shift, heated seats, wireless CarPlay, and given both of our tastes in cars, you will not be shocked to learn that, I mean, if I just said manual transmission alone, like if you go like CarMax or Auto Tempest or something, it just eliminates every car in the country. You could check that checkbox. You go to transmission, like we found 80,000 matches. Check the manual transmission checkbox, 2 matches. That's before you do wireless CarPlay and heated seats. And then before you consider our taste in cars. So,
well, and the problem that you're having is I don't think a brand new car is necessarily going to fix your problem. It might. But it won't necessarily fix your problem because...
Oh, I'm not shopping brand new cars at this point. Those things will search used cars. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not being like, oh, you have to... I'm going to these search sites to try to find, like, the big, mega, ultimate meta search. Try CarMax, try Auto Tempest, try Cars and Bids, try, like, just everything. And the best thing is if you do any search terms first, if you put anything in first, like heated seats, it just removes the manual transmission option from the menu because they know there's zero matches once you've selected that stuff.
Yep. So, I mean, that's the thing, is that I don't think even going new would help you. And going used, I'm tunnel visioned on it because it's sitting, you know, below me in the garage, but a GTI or a Golf R, that would do the trick. I'm trying to think of other sedan, like a handful of year old BMW.
She's listening now and she's trying to claim that she never actually required wireless CarPlay, but I contest this.
Honestly, I'm Team Tina on this
one.
Your
contesting is noted.
Your contesting is noted and ignored. Yeah. I would say a several-year-old BMW, you'd be insane to do it, but you could do that.
So here's an example of a car that exists that would fulfill most of her requirements, especially if you let go of the wireless CarPlay. The very last stick shift Honda Accord you could get with these features on it, right? That was like the 2022, like the previous generation, like the last
one. Yeah, but there are like 4 of them in the country.
Right. So here's the problem. There's a lot of those cars, but the only ones that have, I don't know if she demanded leather, but she wanted leather. But the only one that has leather heated seats and a stick shift, at the end of every Accord generation for many years now, they do the Accord Special Edition. So they'll have like, you know, whatever generation of Accord, it'll be the 2018, 19, 20, 21, 22. Only the 22 model year, the very last model year, will they even offer a special edition, right? So the only Accord that you can get with a stick shift with leather heated seats is the Accord Sport Special Edition in 2022. That car does not exist. That's just, like, everyone, it doesn't exist for sale. The people who bought them are keeping them. They don't come up on any searches. Cars and Bids, maybe one will pop up every once in a while and get snatched up for some ridiculous price. Forget about that car. Nowhere in the entire continental United. You want to get shipped from New Mexico? Sorry, it doesn't exist anywhere. And, you know, how large radius would you like to search? 3,000 miles? Sure, 0 matches. So that eliminated that. So I was looking for stuff. I'm like, is there any car that satisfies these things? Can I find it? And it just... It narrowed down so much to this tiny aperture of acceptable makes, models, and trim levels. Oh, and by the way, I often have a requirement about cars that I've mentioned that you've heard me talk about. No sunroof. You've heard that one, right?
Oh, you are the worst.
Not because I'm against sunroofs, but because I'm for having headroom, and most of my height is in my neck and my upper body. And when I sit in the car, I don't want my head to hit the headliner.
You're losing all your hair anyway. Don't worry about it.
It is true. I'm losing a lot of it, but it's enough of it there that when my head hits the headliner, it is annoying, right?
Yeah, I feel really
try
bad,
adding
yeah.
that into the mix. Leather, heated seats, stick shift, wireless CarPlay.
Yeah, a slick top?
No sunroof?
Yeah, get out of here with the slick top. You're going to have to cave on the slick top.
The Accord Sport Special Edition 2022, I believe, fulfills these requirements, minus maybe the wireless CarPlay, but that car doesn't exist. And so, I'm doing all the research. I'm bringing it back to her saying, yeah, well, you know, this, that, the other thing, whatever. I had to bring her. I said, look, a car exists that fulfills a lot of your requirements, but it's got a sunroof. And she's like, great, buy that.
Okay.
And I said, but the sunroof in my head. And she's like, I don't care. It's my car. What do you care? I'm like, but I don't, even if I never drive your car, I passenge in your car. And my head will be hitting the ceiling.
Is that a verb?
Yeah, I'm making it one right now. And so I went to the car dealer. We went shopping ourselves and went to some car dealers. One of them was closed on Sunday, which I didn't understand.
Yeah, that drives me.
Service department closed on Sunday, fine. The showroom? People shop for cars on weekends. Anyway, I'm like, look, I'll sit in the car. I'll see, because you know, you can say, oh, sunroof takes up headroom or whatever, blah blah blah. And what, by the way, one of the cars we looked at, not that we were going to buy this, but we looked at the Integra. The new Integra.
That is a good answer. That's such a good answer. Why didn't I think of that? Well, it's expensive, but it's such a good answer.
We're not, it's a $50,000 car. We're not getting that. But anyway,
Is Tina not worth it to you? I think she's worth
since it's basically a Civic, I'm like, well, let me check this for headroom. Head was hitting hard in the Integra, but it's not made for me with the sunroof or whatever. But that's not, you know, whatever. So, like, okay, there's one model and one trim level that fulfills your requirement. It's got a sunroof. I will go sit in it. I went by myself to a car dealer to sit in a car to see if it fit my head. And this, I don't like car dealers. No one likes car dealers. I was hoping is, you know, you go in, they got a bunch of cars like indoors, and you can just like wander around and like open the door and sit in them. That's what I wanted to happen, because then I can get in and out in 5 minutes. That didn't happen. There was the car that I wanted was parked out front wanted to sit in. I went in and I asked the receptionist, and I said, can I just go sit? Like, it wasn't one of the inside ones. It was out. So can I just go to that car out there? Can I just go sit in it? And she's like, yeah, sure, go ahead. I don't know if it'll be unlocked, though. I go, of course, it's locked. I come back in. I said, oh, it turns out it was locked. And she says to me, I'm going to have to get a salesperson. And she says it with that look. Like, she knows. She knows what happens when you get a salesperson. Because now you've got a car salesperson. And it's like, I just want to... So. Because they come and they attach to you like a leech, and they want to sell you a car. It's their job. I get it, right? She gets a salesperson. Salesperson comes over, opens the door for me. I sit in it. Headroom's not great. Better than the Integra, though. But headroom's not great. I try the passenger seat. I lean the seat back a little bit. You know what I mean? You try to do all the tricks. Like, of course, the passenger seat does not go up and down at all, right? The driver's seat does go up and down, but it doesn't go down that far. But I'm like, whatever. So... I spent way too long with the salesperson. They did not sell me a car. They tried real hard, though. I went back and I said to my wife, I said, I think I can live with the sunroof since it's your car. It's not as bad as the Integra. I will suffer with my head hitting the headliner if this is what you want. And she said, yes, it was. And I did the search. How many cars with these features in the color that we wanted exist within, let's say, 500 miles?
Well, with the color that you want, I mean, at this point, you're looking for a needle in a haystack, and then you're going to say, I want a blue or whatever, red needle?
Yeah, right. Color matters. Again, if I'm spending new car money, I want a car that I like.
Wait, did you tell us what car it is? Did I miss this?
Not yet. We're getting to it.
Okay. All right.
And how many existed? Two. 500 mile, two. Two
okay,
exist.
Stop right there. Please. Please, John, for the love that is, of everything that is good and holy, if that car is anywhere near or even better on the other side of Virginia, I will give you all of my money if we can road trip that bad boy back to Boston. I will do anything to be on that trip.
Well, they
you.
Do like the, you know, you would assume that if it's far away that you could do some kind of dealer trade with a local dealer or whatever. But anyway, two cars. So I'm like, all right. So I We're just noodling. We're just thinking, just like, well, whatever. I'm not buying a car. We were visiting car dealers. I'm sitting in them. We're not buying a car. I'm just looking around. But then there's like two. And so I send emails to people. I contact them through their various websites or whatever. And I say, hey, I've got VIN numbers now, right? I say, hey, do you actually have this car? That's question number
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that's good. You know, yeah.
Fair, right? Fair.
And you may be shocked to learn that car dealers are anxious to get back to you about cars. They get back to me and say, yeah, I have this car. I ask them a second question, which is, can you just tell me what color it is? Because I don't want to give them the answer. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want them to tell me, yeah, we have, I want them to go and look at it, right? And they tell me the correct answer. And they're all like, this is the big thing with car dealers. This wasn't last time. They were like, when should we schedule a test drive? When do you want to schedule a test drive? Do you want to schedule a test drive? Let's schedule a test drive. When are you going to come and look at this? I'm like, I'm just asking you questions over email, person. Chill out, right? They're being salesperson.
Find some chill.
Right? And then, I forget what day this was. This was like Monday of this week. And I was like, there's two of these cars. I really don't like any of the other colors. She really seems to want a car. We've already given up on giving the kids what they want. So one of the dealers, the one that's closer to her work, I say, I call her at work and I say, don't come home. Rather than going home, do you want to just go to the car dealer that's near your work and look at this car?
She's like, my God. Did you impulse buy a car, John Syracuse?
So I wouldn't call this impulse buying if you based the amount of research I'd done up to this point. But anyway.
No, fair, fair.
But I'm at the point now where I know there's two. So I drive up there to her. We both drive together to the dealer, which is, you know, further up from where her work is. We look at this car. She test drives it. She likes it. You know, the headroom is better than the Integra. I can live with it. We go back, and I'm like, well, I think we should get this car.
Oh, my word.
Because, like, look, I spent like a month on this. Like, we know when we recorded the member special, I was already looking into this then, which is why I brought up the question. And I was like, I don't have any other answers. This is the best answer to this problem. And if we don't get this car, yeah, and so, like, here I am in a situation where I'm going to negotiate the price of a new car with a salesperson, trying not to let them know that according to my searches, two of these exist within 500 miles.
Yeah, like you're buying this car no matter what they make you pay for it.
So screwed.
Part of my research was like I'd mentioned that the like a person who asked about new cars, and I mentioned that Car Edge service. I had signed up for that a little while ago, and that one of the things they'll give you is a lot of services do is like, you know, what is like the invoice price? What would be a fair price for this car? You know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I had. Before I went to this deal, like, this would be a fair price for the car, minus any kind of, like, incentives or whatever. It's like, it gives them a little bit of profit to the dealership. They'll probably accept this, but you're not getting ripped off. I had that price in my mind. Went into that negotiation. I'm very proud of myself. I got within $100 of that price.
Well done!
Right?
How many times did you have to
within $100 of the, quote-unquote, fair price for the thing. Part of it was by saying, well, I have two other cars, two other dealers I can go to. And I listed the one in the color that I didn't like, because, of course, I never told them I didn't like the color. Don't tell the dealer what colors you like, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was, you know, it was a blue one. I was like, you know, well, there's a blue one and another white one. And the dealer was pushing back.
Wait, a white car just happened to you?
Oh, my God.
And this is getting more and more delicious.
Yeah. And it was like, well, is that other car, are you sure that's not the same car as this? Because we got a call from a dealer about this car and they wanted to take it from us or whatever. I'm like, no, these are other cars. I can show you the emails. I'm like, here's whatever. Like, to basically let him think there are other places where I could go for this car, even though I would never buy the blue one, right?
Oh, my God.
And so, anyway, I got within $100 of the price.
Oh, my God. He got
very proud
car.
Of myself. He's going through the thing. Okay, we agreed on this price. And then, you know, obviously tax title and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's, you know, that's the thing about the car edge thing. They don't include tax title or whatever in the fair price. Right? We agree on the price. And then he says, and then, of course, $129 for the locking wheel nuts.
I'm sorry, what? No. Absolutely
the
not.
The locking wheel nuts. And I said, well, I don't want locking wheel nuts. He's like, well, they're already on the car.
Well, take them off.
I said, yeah, well, why don't you take them off? I was like, well, but they're already on the car. And I was like,
I'm sorry, no.
And I was like, everything was going so smoothly. And I basically got into a shouting match with this guy. I was like, look, when we agreed upon this price, when we agreed, like, this is going to be the price before tax, title, and fees, it was the price for the car that's sitting out there. Whatever's on that car, that was what we were negotiating, this number. We weren't negotiating this number plus other things. And he takes me out to the car and he's like, on the sticker, it has like $129 locking wheel nuts as a separate line item. It's like, I don't care. We were negotiating for that car. Everything that car is. not parts of that car, not partial. It was that car, and that was this number. And then we would add tax, titles, and fees. And so, like, I'd never gotten so angry at a car in my entire life. Anyway, he went back to his manager and took the $129 off.
Mm-hmm. Damn right he did. Good for you, John.
And he made some big excuse of, like, you know, we can't take it off the price, but we'll just subtract it. Also, I don't care what you subtract it, dude. Just subtract it, right?
Right.
Oh, and then, by the way, you know, incentives of, like, is there any incentives? Can we do any blah, 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 blah. The one incentive that we were eligible for was the Honda loyalty program thing. And yes, now you're revealing everything about it. Guess what? We are loyal Honda customers. And I got another $500 off just because I already own a Honda.
Oh, good for you.
As you should have already guessed by now, what is the only car this could possibly be? It is the Honda Civic in the most expensive trim level the Honda Civic is offered in, because that is the only one that has wireless CarPlay, leather seats, and heated seats.
Oh, my God.
And a stick shift. And a sunroof.
I cannot believe you just bought yourself bought Tina a white Civic. This line in the show, in our internal show notes, Kid Car Revisited, that has sat there for like 2 weeks. If I had known that this was the direction this conversation was going,
This happened this week.
We should have done an emergency episode.
I picked
episode,
up the car today.
Oh my
Wait,
God.
So is it a Civic Si or a Civic Civic?
No, we looked at the Si, but it wasn't the specs, the requirements that I just gave you are not available in the Si. And also the Si is more expensive. We could have saved $5,000 if she didn't want heated seats. We could have got the sport trim. With the $5,000.
Really,
these are $5,000
really
heated seats.
Especially because, like, you live in New England. Like, winter is a big part of your life.
Doesn't have heated seats. I think it's fine. But she wants them. So she got
After this, she deserves the heated seats, damn it. This is a turbocharged car. I don't think you've owned a turbocharged car.
Yeah, it's first turbocharged. I mean, they're all turbos now, you know.
Yeah. I'm just saying. Wow.
We got a white Honda Civic hatchback.
A hatch? You got a hatch?
The hatchback and sedan look so similar in the Civic. I wanted a hatchback because we don't have a hatchback. And as you know, as Marco knows, hatchbacks have a lot of utility.
I'm sorry. Am I making this up? Didn't you give me boatloads of crap for not having a car-shaped car?
Yeah, I don't want a Volkswagen Rabbit or a Golf. I don't want that kind of hatchback. Look at the car. It looks exactly like the sedan. It's just, like, it's barely different in profile. It looks like a sedan. That's why I got it.
Okay. Sure.
This looks a lot like Casey's car.
Sure does.
And why did I pick white?
It's white.
It's the best color for this car.
What?
Absolutely. The Si also, the Civic Type R. Also looks best in white.
I don't even see white as an option here. Oh, no, there I do. Never mind. Sorry. I have the, what is it, Noir or whatever it is, that synthetically darkens websites. And so I had that on. And the white paint swatch was colored black because dark mode, by mistake. This doesn't look bad. This looks nice.
Yeah, people wondering, you know, our recommendations for buying cars and the services we offer and the advice we have, I just followed all that and this is what I ended up with. So
a white hatchback happened to you.
I wanted the hatchback. I absolutely wanted it because I it's useful to have something with a hatch for, like, taller items, especially since this is smaller than the Accord, right? And so I'm going to get a small, like, if the sedan version of this, the trunk is very confined. The opening is confined. It is very confined. The hatch really helps with that. It gives you way more space than you get with the sedan version. And it looks almost like the sedan. So all of my, you know, hatred of hatchbacks that look like a Volkswagen Rabbit doesn't apply to this car. Who knows if I'll ever get to drive it anyway. It's my wife's car. So anyway, the kids are driving her old car, as they have always been. They have always been driving that car, and they will continue to drive it, and now we have three stick shift cars. And just to review, my history of car purchases go like this. Civic, Civic, Accord, 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 Civic. All stick shift.
You're pretty consistent, at least.
You are consistent, which is funny because I have never bought more than one car from the same company. So, you know,
I have never bought cars from any other company except for Honda.
Did you even look at, like, a GTI or anything like
that?
We
like Hondas. We like them.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that there's not other better things.
We looked
things,
at other
John.
Things. It's just, I mean, we're a Honda family, and we got $500 off for being a Honda family.
I mean, they are good cars. Like, I'll give you that. You know, you are consistent in at least something that's good.
Even things like they haven't screwed themselves up. Like, they haven't gone, like, all touchscreen or done anything weird. The interior is, I think, my favorite mix of physical and touchscreen type controls. Yeah.
The real question is, are you going to, for your future car purchases, convert to hatchback once you realize how good it is?
No, I'm gonna, hopefully I'm going to convert to EV. That's what's going to happen to me, but not anytime soon.
But you just crapped all over every EV on the market.
I know, but eventually all the EVs will change to NACS and there'll be EV sedans that I like. Like, this is going to be years in the future.
Yeah, this is congratulations to really Tina for getting what she wanted, because I cannot imagine the amount of bickering and grief that you gave her over heated seats, and most especially summer.
I just tried to convince her and she didn't want to be convinced. So there was no heated arguments. I just needed to sit in it and be able to say, I can tolerate this. I can passenge and not die.
That's a glowing review.
Yeah, because like the Integra, I was really surprised. The Integra was worse. It did feel like they're basically the same car. Like that's why I was part of the reason I was showing her the Integra. She's like, why can't I get a fancy car like Integra? I'm like, A, the good one is $50,000, and B, this is just a Civic. When you see the Civic, you'd be like, oh, like, and you sit inside them, they're very, very similar. And by the way, finding stick shift Integras, talking to the dealer who was there, is also very difficult. The packaging is better on the Civic. The Civic is just a better car than the Integra, unless you get the Type S, and those are very expensive and don't exist.
The Integra Type S, you mean?
The Integra Type S.
Oh, yeah.
They're very hard to come by, and they're very expensive, much more than we wanted to spend.
Well, I'm very curious. Well, again, congratulations. You've done this well. You've done it right. I'm proud of you for sticking to your guns about the locking wheel lug nut, whatever things. You know, it's funny, when we bought the Volvo, I'm sure I've told this story, but when we bought the Volvo, I told the dealer, I do not want any stickers on that car. I do not want a plate.
I totally forgot. I do that same thing. And I totally, after we came home from the dealer, after negotiating the price and saying we're going to buy it, I'm like, oh, I forgot to tell them all those things you just said. No, yep. You know, sticker,
yeah,
no
dealer
plaque,
branding.
No, whatever. I was like, oh, like, stupid me. Like, I buy a car once every 7 to 10 years. So, you know, but like, I totally forgot. I was so mad at myself.
Yeah. Well, so when we bought the Volvo, which was 7 years ago in like a week or something like that, July of 2017. Anyways, I vividly remember going to the car and saying, oh, the sticker's there. And the salesperson looked at me like, yeah. We're not going to buy this car. And he's like, what? As I told you, I will not have this sticker on this car. And he rolled his eyes so hard that I think they fell out of his damn head. But then he had like a mechanic or who knows, or detail or whatever, come over with like a heat gun and pull the sticker off the car. And I was not going to sign any paperwork until he did. And I stand by it, and I will stand by it forever.
That's pretty nice of him, considering you'd already agreed to buy that car and signed all the paperwork for it.
No, I don't think I had signed it at that point.
If you hadn't signed it, then yes, you have the power there. But yeah, the good news is, because even though I totally forgot about this, this dealer was great. Not only did they not put anything on this car, he pointed out to me, I noticed this already, but he pointed out to my salesperson, I didn't even put a license plate surround on you for you.
Nice.
Like, thank you.
That's
like,
good stuff.
It's just literally, like, no, I've never seen this. Everyone always does license. It's easy to take that off and just unscrew it or whatever. But then he didn't even put that on, and he pointed it out to me, because he could tell, based on me yelling at him about the lug nuts, that I didn't want that. And I was like, thank you. I appreciate that. He was,
is Massachusetts a barbaric commonwealth front, like we
yeah,
are?
Front plate states. Yeah. It is. It's fine.
I hate it. I hate it so much. Virginia is a front plate barbaric commonwealth.
I don't think it's barbaric. I think it's fine, but we've got the front plates.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to Tina. I'm glad she stuck to her guns and got what she wanted. See, she did the negotiation with you, so you would do the negotiation with the dealer.
Yeah, she doesn't deal with the dealer. She just watches me do it. I think she was a little bit upset when I was yelling. And by the way, all of our cars have locking lug nuts. It's just that I'd never want to pay for them because I didn't ask for them. So if you're going to put them on there, I'm getting them for free.
I have to concede. I am a little upset at Tina, because I would have given infinite dollars to have a video recording of you yelling at this dealer, and would have given nearly infinite dollars for a voice memos recording of you yelling at the dealer.
As listeners to this podcast would know, it's not angry yelling. It's incredulous yelling. Like, when you hear me on the podcast talking about some bad software feature, it's like, no, I was like, we just negotiated the price for that. I was literally pointing for that car. That's the number we agreed on. Remember that whole thing where we were talking about the numbers and you're going to ask your manager or whatever, and we agreed on a number. We said, yes, this is a number we can both agree. It was for that car. Everything that's in that car, that's the number we agreed on. It was just, I was incredulous. I'm like, are you kidding me? You can't say, and also other parts of that car we're now going to itemize and add to the price. So would I have not bought the car with the 100 at that point? I probably would have. Oh, here's the final kicker, right? When I came home and like reloaded one of my tabs that had that search in it,
oh no,
zero matches. So guess what? That car that was listed twice, there was one of these cars.
Oh.
At 500 miles, and I just bought it. Because, you could say, impulse bought it. After a month of research, I saw that it was available. I saw it had been on the market for 29 days, and I found the one that was near. And I was lucky we picked. They both said they had the car, but only one of them really had the car. And we randomly picked that one because it was close to my wife's work. And so that's when incredible. I bought that car, it disappeared. Now there's zero of these cars within 500 miles.
That's incredible. I'm a little sad that we didn't get to do a road trip together, but ultimately I'm glad that a white car
I was
and a white hatchback
ship,
happened.
Ready to ship a car from New Mexico and CarMax, but you know, because it's like, oh, rust free, it'll be great.
All right, let's do some titles. We were running late, but I don't care.
Yeah, I'm sorry that went long, but
no, it's worth it. I do not care.
On you.
Let's see. She's seen the forbidden fruit. That was pretty good, though. That was the after show.
I like buy your car an iPhone. That was good.
Buy your car an iPhone is actually very good. You're right. She's the Marco is very good.
Bad building blocks, I kind of like.
What was bad building blocks?
It was what the sightings is made of.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. Let's see. What was that'll hasten the timeline? Or that
I don't think that's grammatically correct, so I think that's why people were putting it in to make fun of me for saying something not grammatically correct.
All right, let's see.
That was like a moving up the timeline of me buying a new Mac.
Oh, okay.
Buying the most expensive car we've ever purchased just pushed back the timeline.
I think I like Buy Your Car an iPhone and She's Seen the Forbidden Fruit. I know it's an after show title, but it is very good. Let's see.
I think Buy Your Car an iPhone is my favorite so far.
Oh, and obviously not next episode, but eventually we should have an after show where I complain about all the modern features this car has that can't be disabled easily.
Well, like auto
yes,
start,
please.
Stop.
Yeah, among others, yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm currently battling them, considering I just brought the car home today. But in a future episode, we will discuss.
Start-stop is actually relatively livable. Well, no, in a stick-shift car, it's actually somewhat livable, because the only stick-shift car I ever drove that had start-stop was a BMW I test drove years ago. And that one, when you depress the clutch, it would turn the car back on. You know, uh-huh. So you're sitting idle off the clutch, you're in neutral. And when you're not idle because the motor is turned off. But anyway, when you push the clutch in, that's when it would kick on the motor. Or maybe it was when you selected a gear. I forget which. But it was actually quite a bit better in a stick shift than it is in like Aaron's car, because by the time you actually need it, it's already on. Whereas with an automatic, you know, you take your foot off the brake and you want it to already be starting to creep. And it's not. It's trying to start again. Anyway, titles.
I think looking forward to Siri.
Like 7-year itch, but I would take out the and I would do it like the movie title, I guess. Let me see. Is it the movie title have the? Let me check.
I still think Buy Your Car an iPhone is better, but none of these I would veto.
The 7-year itch spelled out. I would like that one. Oh, that's an after show title.
That's fine. This is a good after show.
Well, the 7-year itch and bad building blocks are my top two.
Of those, I would do 7-year itch.
I'm going to go Buy Your Car an iPhone and looking forward to Siri.
Well, I mean, I like Buy Your Car an iPhone and I like 7-year itch. So who wants to give?
How about 7-year itch without the?
No, because it's referencing the movie. Well, it's referencing like, you know, the cliche, but
it is. But
I think the cliche probably came from the movie.
Yeah.
The movie's from forever ago. So it probably, I bet that's why those are the cliche. I don't know.
Bad building blocks is my number one, though. No one likes that, I guess.
It's fine.
It's fine.
I think Buy Your Car an iPhone is more...
Concur.
It's, you know, better, more entertaining.
Well, you two like that one, so there you go.
All right.
I think it's fine.
Going in the robot.
No one like looking forward to Siri. All right, cool.
All right, goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people. We're going to continue
Monday,
with overtime now.
We don't know what time Monday, but Monday is the theory.
Yeah,
sometime
the State of the Union is probably going to end somewhere around 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. So we're thinking we were probably going to record sometime around 3 p.m. Pacific or 6 p.m. Eastern on Monday. So we will see. It'll be something like that.
No promises, but that's the plan.
Yeah. All right. Bye, live people. We will stand for the bootleg for overtime, and see you next week.
Bye.